regarding anything you hear in this podcast, don't ever take my word for it. Always research what you hear. Don't let anyone think for you. Most people can barely think for themselves.
And now stand by for adventure.
Helmut Schreiber. Who? Well, you might know him better as Kalanag, the Nazi magician.
Da bin ich wieder, Sim Salabim.
This is it. This is the real thing. You've heard about it on the radio and seen it in the papers. 10 big acts for the price of one ticket. Behind this curtain, you'll see the Fiji mermaid, the giant red bat, the 6-foot man-eating chicken. They're all real and they're all on the inside. You'll see the Ethiopian glass eater.
Come on, folks, what are you waiting for? Admission is free to Ballycast, the podcast of the carnival, sideshow, and variety arts. You're just in time. We're going to have a free show. We're going to bring out the strange people, the weird people. Here they come now. Watch the doorway. You'll see what they do. You'll hear what they talk about. They're all alive on the inside. Get your ticket and come in. Ballycast presents news and interviews with performers and showmen. Some important words of warning. This podcast is not family friendly. I'm not even thinking about it. So listen at your own risk. The performances and stunts described are not safe, even for experienced performers. Never attempt them without the direct supervision of someone who already performs them. Please use your common sense. And if you don't have any, stop listening now. Here's your host, Wayne Kaiser.
Welcome to Ballycast, episode 198, a podcast for showmen, performers, and fans of the sideshow, carnival, and variety arts. In today's show, Kalanag, the Nazi magician. You'll also hear news, a favorite carnival food recipe, and a whole lot more. Slippery when wet, it's Ballycast.
Here we go. Keep your hands and arms inside the car and remain seated until the ride comes to a complete stop.
Just letting you know, I'm going to dial back on the Nazi in chief. There's just no point. He can't stop, and soon he'll do something even more outrageous and get thrown out on his ass. And any more complaining from me will certainly bore you even worse. And by the way, if ICE wants to come through my door, I have protection, and I don't mean birth control. In fact, my whole family does. So let's get on with what we're doing right here.
Who needs enemies to suffer like you? see, you walk around doing the things that you do. But I want you to know that somewhere, somehow, that someone's going to get right back to you. I said, I want you to know, yeah, yeah. You've got to know. I want you to know. Oh, isn't it a shame? You go around playing those dirty games. We're talking about dirty, 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 dirty games.
Duncan, author of Chariots of the Gods. A book that came along at the right moment to amp up the notion that visiting space aliens had somehow advanced early apes to a level of incredible sophistication. That word incredible, you know, that means not believable. His book sold 60 million copies, making him the biggest-selling nonfiction author of his day, and started a whole genre of conspiracy-based science fiction, like The X-Files and on and on and on. He was a troublemaker all his life, even jailed for fraud once, and he designed a theme park in Switzerland that was open for about 3 years. Pavilions there included ones devoted to cargo cults, the Nazca Lines, the Maya calendar, Stonehenge. You know, there are stone circles all over Europe, and more. Every theory discredited.
The neighboring atoll is called the Island of the Bird People. Here we see them, creatures with human bodies and the heads of birds. Are these really birds' heads? Or do they just theme that way to the natives? They could also be helmets equipped with oxygen masks.
Not a single responsible scientist gives an ounce of credibility to von Däniken's theories.
The temples were built by the Greeks and Romans in historical times, but they were erected on a skillfully constructed foundation composed of the largest stone masses ever trimmed and positioned on Earth. The largest of these blocks are 65 feet long, 15 feet high, and over 12 feet wide, and weigh almost 2,000 tons. This terrace was ancient when the temples were built on it. Archaeologists still have no explanation for the terrace, nor for the transport of its components. The Russian research scientist Agrest submits that it served as a launching pad for travelers from outer space.
Recent, reputable studies give greater appreciation to the abilities of primitive people and even animals, but not in this off-the-wall way. But he still has followers. This calls for something more intelligent.
With a key, you unlock a door to imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sight. A dimension of sound. A dimension of mind. You're moving through a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. Guiding you through this wondrous journey is the hypnotic sound of the Twilight Zone.
This is a song about vegetables. They keep you regular. They're real good for you.
Call any vegetable.
Call any vegetable.
Call it by name.
Call any vegetable.
Call one today.
Call
when you get off a train.
Call any vegetable.
Call any vegetable. And the chances are good. All the vegetable will respond to you.
Some people don't go for prunes. I don't know. I've always found that if they...
Call any vegetable.
Call any vegetable.
Pick up your phone.
Call any vegetable.
Think of a vegetable.
Call any
vegetable. Lonely
at
home.
Call any vegetable.
Call any vegetable. And the chances are good. A vegetable will respond to you.
Rutabaga, 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 rutabaga.
What's a four-way joint? It's not something you need to have fixed by a doctor. From 1948, this 9-page detailed plan shows the easy and efficient way to build a traditional carnival concession booth customers can play from all four sides. Also included, illustrated plans for 11 money-grabbing four-sided midway games suitable for use in such a joint. Games like Penny Pitch, Cane Rack, Pitch Till You Win, and 8 more.
A PDF copy emailed to you is just $5. Click the link on this episode's webpage. If you're traveling to any country, especially destinations you've never been to before, you might get some important information from the CIA World Factbook. Yes, that's CIA. The World Factbook provides basic information on the history, people, government, economy, communications, transportation, terrorism, and other issues for 258 world countries. There's a print version, but it's also online. In December's episode, I mentioned Diana Phillips' new book on Priscilla Bejano, the monkey girl. What Diana has to say includes so much more than just one person. She writes, "If you can't come see me, please buy my book. It's only $20.
I'm a third-generation circus performer. The first time I ever performed, I was 3 years old. There's not a feeling that's any better in this world than when you are out there performing."
She grew up among them and also took an interest in photography, starting with photos around the house of Priscilla Bejano, the monkey girl, after Priscilla had retired. Diana was taking pictures of her dogs and her plants and made a photo album of them for Priscilla. That's when Priscilla said, "Kid, you need to do something with this." Priscilla had a lot to say about other Gibbetown residents, like lobster boy Grady Stiles.
"It was hereditary, the whole family, except women and married. The one that got shot by his wife deserved it. He got what it coming to him. When he was a kid, he was mean. You know, if you play cards with him and he didn't like what you were doing, he'd take them crab, stick them right in you. He was married 6 or 7 times, different women. He did all his women the same way. And he'd have a kid like him every time. Put him in show business. Terrible."
She entered the photos into the state fair and won a ribbon for each one. Now she's published a book of her photos, documenting her life in the carnival capital of the world. It's surprisingly affordable. It's called Gibbetown Through the Camera Lens of Diana Phillips. I'm thinking it might sell even faster if someone tried to ban it. Be sure to get your copy before they're sold out. I'll include the direct link to the book on this episode's webpage.
Scene 1, Apple, take 1.
"We have a number of very important goals to accomplish together in this first lesson. Our overall goal, of course, is to get you your all-important first job in radio. But before you can get your first job, your voice must be trained to a professional level. As you will see, this involves more than merely strengthening your voice and increasing its resonance. In this first lesson, we will teach you how to avoid provincialisms in your speech, how to correct nasality and other voice faults, and how to develop a new approach toward enunciation of words. In this lesson, we will give you your first practice in delivering commercial messages."
All this recent talk of book bans and every sort of censorship, it comes back now and then when times are tough, but nobody knows how to address the problems. None of it does any good at all. If they want to keep you from hearing or reading things, that only draws attention to those things every time.
"In middle school, I erased the black crayon censored of texts and images and found depictions under it of strange, unkosher animals and naughty but tingly words like pregnancy. In high school, I discovered that the Merriam-Webster dictionary that was required for school had wild secrets in it, if you knew how to look. Some gleeful girls rushed from the page for sex and intercourse to the one for penis and vagina, and on in confusion, delight, and horror. After September 11, when I was a girl of marriageable age, I figured out that my Sony Walkman could play the radio on 770 from my bedroom closet.
So let's cover censorship. Actually, censorships. Pirate radio stations broadcasting from ships in international waters to listeners on the land. And at the end, this topic will spiral around to involve a magician. Pirate radio was a popular medium in the UK since the 1960s, at its peak from the 60s to the 1990s. But it's still there today, with many stations still operating mostly from tower blocks across the country. All of the broadcasting at that time came without any advertising by way of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. The government decided what was good for you to hear, and it was an offense to listen to unauthorized broadcasts. The audience there needed a wireless license to listen to radio or watch TV. The fee for the license went to help support the BBC and detector vehicles cruised neighborhoods checking which homes had radios or televisions. But some rebellious young'uns decided that radio supported by ads was a great way to make a lot of money. And the heck with music like the old fogies like to hear. Here's just a bit of what rebellious listeners to that naughty forbidden radio might have heard in 1967. Broadcasting from aboard a decommissioned former U.S. Navy minesweeper, beaming radio all the way from the North Sea.
This is Radio Caroline on 199, England's first commercial radio station. My name's Simon D, with you for the next 2 hours. First one off the top of the pile, The Hollies, Rockin' Robin.
Caroline Sure Shot!
He rocks the streets outside the day long, hopping and a popping and a singing his song. Every little bird, every little bee loves to hear.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's the Caroline Flashback.
From a point at sea to the circles of your mind, a new force is at work for planetary transformation. New radio for a new Earth on 963 kilohertz medium wave. Europe's voice of loving awareness is Radio Caroline.
Good morning, oh Caroline.
Caroline International, station with the happy
difference.
Stones there, of course, from their first LP, and Now I've Got a Witness. Playing that again makes me wonder, you know, because back in the old days, there's a program called Shindig on TV in the States, and the Rolling Stones were on that, and it was the first time I'd ever seen them on television, and they went mad. You know, I used to sit there and just roll about because of Bill Wyman, stand there like a pillar of salt with his bass pointing up at the ceiling and absolutely sort of face immobile and just put out these terrific sounds. Marvelous it was. The Rolling Stones, I had to present them on stage once in California too, in a place called San Bernardino. And it's one of the most incredible nights of my entire life because I had to stand right behind them to sort of make sure nobody got at them from the back. And One boy got up on stage and grabbed Mick Jagger's tambourine, and this policeman grabbed hold of him, you know, to get him away. And he grabbed hold of the policeman's gun, and this is incredible. I don't think the Stones know about it even to this day. He grabbed hold of the policeman's gun and emptied it into the stage, you know, fired off 6 shots into the stage about 3 feet in front of Mick Jagger, who didn't flinch, you know, just kept on singing. It was altogether too much. It was incredible. An extraordinary night that was. Anyway, that seems to be the lights are flashing. I hope we're not off the air. Are we off the air, Willie? He's not listening. Oh, I can't. I mustn't do that. I hope we're not off the air. Lights are flashing, which usually mean that we are, but it also means that the engineers may be playing around upstairs, which broke the spell, which is probably just as well, actually, because there's no telling what on earth I would have done. And the only way that I can get... I'm supposed to do a commercial right now, you see. And that's very good.
There's a whole new world awaiting you in show business. You can be a star DJ on radio or in discotheques if you have the know-how. Getting that know-how is no problem for the really keen young men and women who want to make show business their career. At the School of Broadcasting, we've the finest studio equipment, and star DJs will teach you speech delivery, disc spinning, programming, microphone techniques, and the use of all studio equipment. We at the School of Broadcasting can start you on this exciting career for £35. Write to us for even more information at the School of Broadcasting, 7 Norfolk Street, Strand, London WC2.
I almost failed disc spinning, actually. It was very close. It's 1:02 and time for us to check the weather, or at least it was a couple of minutes ago.
Radio London, Big L!
Things these kids listen to these days, such rude music, ought to be illegal. Soon there were pirate radio ships off every coast of the UK, and then many countries in other corners of Europe. The government tried to respond to this. It didn't go well.
I don't think that if people knew and understood the truth about the pirates, they'd like them very much. What are they doing? They're playing records that musicians have recorded and giving them no money for. They're endangering the ship-to-shore radio, and there's a real risk that distress at sea might not be reported because of the inadequate fumbling handling of equipment. The pirates are a menace, and I don't believe at all that the public wouldn't support action to enforce the law in the interests of all these people whom I've mentioned.
We got one man on when suddenly, over the top, a number of heavy gas cylinders were thrown at us, a half a dozen Molotov cocktails, glass bottles with petrol or paraffin in, which were alight.
But the newspapers printed daily program schedules for several of these stations. The law over there has changed since that day of censor-happy officials, but pirate radio is still there today, with many stations still operating mostly from tower blocks across the country. On YouTube, you'll find instructions for how you can set up a pirate radio station in the UK without getting caught. It's been tried over here in New York City and Oregon and probably other places, but the FCC comes down hard on unlicensed stations for what may be good reasons.
A pirate radio station is one that broadcasts illegally without a valid license from the FCC. It's sometimes referred to as bootleg, clandestine, or free radio. Today, pirate radio is being reinvented through new technology. Smaller, more highly mobile pirate radio stations can dangerously interfere with public safety and even air traffic control frequencies. They also compete with licensed broadcasters for revenue. It's so serious a problem that the Prevention of Illegal Radio Abuse Through Enforcement, or Pirate Act, became law in 2020. This allows the FCC to enforce stiff penalties against radio pirates, $100,000 per day per violation, up to $2 million. That's a lot of pirates' booty. You can rest assured our Enforcement Bureau is dedicated to tracking down pirate operators and banishing them forever from the high seas of our airwaves.
And here's an interesting follow-up. Go back to a day in 1903. There's quite a crowd in the Royal Institution's lecture hall in London as physicist John Fleming is just about to demonstrate the sending of a Morse code message by wireless a very long distance, and to do it securely. Behind it all was Fleming's boss, Guglielmo Marconi, inventor of wireless technology. Marconi had recently written in a journal, "I can tune my instruments so that no other that is not similarly tuned can tap my messages." the old telegraph companies had spent millions building poles and undersea cables for their wires, and Marconi was quickly patenting his radio system. All their investments would be worthless if Marconi's wireless technology worked. One company found Neville Maskelyne, a young music hall magician who was glad to test Marconi's new and supposedly unbreakable wireless system. Maskelyne set up a transmitter close to the Royal Institution Hall, and while the crowd was waiting to hear a signal from about 300 miles from a station in Cornwall, the London receiver started tapping out, "Rats, rats, rats, rats," and then there was a young fellow of Italy who diddled the public quite prettily and then went on with even naughtier jokes. The demonstration had been hacked, showing that an untuned receiver could still easily listen to or override anything being sent. Marconi was outraged. He called it
scientific hooliganism, an outrage against the traditions of the Royal Institution.
He asked the newspaper's readers to help him find the culprit. Just 4 days later, the Times published a gleeful letter from Maskelyne confessing to the hack.
"It was pointed out to me that the practical demonstrations accompanying the lecture rendered independent tests possible. I at once grasped the fact that the opportunity was too good to be missed. The only hope, then, was to interpolate messages calculated to anger and draw somebody at the receiving end. If that could be done, there would be proof positive."
I'll include on this episode's webpage a link to one of Maskelyne's magic books, available free from the Internet Archive. There's money to be made with a good joint on the carnival lot, but to make that money, you need some good games to get the cash out of their grubby little hands. You'll be in the middle where customers can file past your joint, and here are 24 games that pay. Games like Duck Ring Toss, Horizontal Dart Game, Three Pin Bowling, Postcard Pickout, and 20 more. They're all here. 12 pages of solid money makers, including detailed instructions and illustrations, restored from an original plan by famous Carnier and Brill. These are easy and cheap to build, and they draw paying customers. You do the rest and rake in the dough. A PDF copy emailed to you is just $5. It's easy to order. The link is on the webpage for this episode. See you on the lot or on your way to the bank. Here in America, now that cable TV is largely taken over, local cable companies are often required to provide fully staffed and professionally equipped public access TV studios for a community television channel. These channels often train volunteer staff to assist individual programs. I used to have a show on one of these in my area for a year or two. My county even provides a full schedule of the programming on its website. By the way, a little advice. If you're a performer or anyone else needing to communicate with strangers, and you have a website, and why wouldn't you, I keep seeing one big mistake. These sites do impressive but unnecessary visual tricks. You, the owner, are paying some designer to code all the fanciness, but your site does not have, up front and prominent on every page, the address, phone, email, and a link, if needed, to how anyone can get what you're selling. Every page. And a little more history. Lamentable? Of course. A German named Helmut Schreiber, the favorite magician of the Nazis. born in 1903, died in 1963, the film producer and magician known as the court magician of the Nazis. He had good contacts to Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, and in 1936, he helped produce the film Robert and Bertram, the only anti-Semitic musical comedy.
Ohne dich und deine Liebe kann ich nicht mehr sein. Drum geht's.
Magicians and illusionists were accepted by the Nazi regime as long as they followed the regulations.
Und ein Papier, wenn man zeigt, hier ist es, nicht wahr? So, jetzt kommt die Hauptsache, du mit der Zeit. Hier drauf, dass nichts passiert. So, ganz deutlich. Wo ist das Glas hier?
Hier.
Aufpassen, durch den Tisch durch. Sim, sala. Here's the glass.
Schreiber was close enough to the inner circle around Hitler to be a guest at the wedding of Eva Braun's sister, and Braun later hired Schreiber and his wife Gloria to entertain Hitler and his friends for 2 weeks in April 1944. He'd give magic shows almost every evening in the Great Hall of the Berghof, where Hitler was often seen laughing and applauding. He fled to the British occupation zone in Hamburg, where he lived with a magic friend known as the King of the Black Market. In 1947, as the post-war period turned into a post-war boom, he entertained British occupation soldiers with his Kalanag Review. Elaborate illusions with scantily dressed showgirls. Several other magicians Schreiber had harmed during the Nazi days called for boycotts of his shows. In the 1950s, Kalanag toured many countries, including the U.S., with an ensemble of 50, making him the only major illusionist who still toured with such an elaborate show. According to his daughter, he lived very unhealthily and was very overweight. He left his divorced wife, Gloria, $500,000 Deutschmarks, and for the rest of her life, she looked for clues to Nazi gold, which she assumed that he had hidden somewhere. To bring this sorry but intriguing legacy to its conclusion, in spring 2025, the Staatsoperette Dresden announced the world premiere of a new musical. Simsalabim, the magic life of Dr. Schreiber. Oh, and by the way, subscribe.
Subscribe?
You should do it, goddammit!
Really, you should subscribe.
They really should.
It's still free.
Goddamn better.
Jesus Christ, you should do it.
Before we get to the fair food recipe, many of you have requested the week's lunch menu for the local school districts.
Developmental Valley School District luncheon menus for this week. Plain Elementary School. Monday, paper stack, boneless burrito, paste, kitten on a stick, milk-a-roni. Tuesday, white bread on toast, glass of sugar, see-through lettuce, liquid milk. Wednesday, cake sponge, sugar sandwich, butter plate, cloth pudding, milk. Thursday, simple pie, banana splat, sugar mound, blanched cookie, whey. Friday, diaper surprise, clear peaches, steamed cereal boxes, sugar, milk. And for Mystery Island School for Girls, Monday, soft eggs on a mirror, hard-boiled hollow birds, handful of tacos, milk. Tuesday, rack of clever haunts, whisked apple fly, coronation ham, nylon bunnies, big carton. Wednesday, mystery potato, curd, slippery tart, milk pie, leg salad sandwich, clear liquid. Thursday, oysters frightened by chickens, liver mounds, nest of interesting spiders, Mai Tai, pack of camels. Friday, breast of clam a la Eddie, wieners in a basket under a blanket, teacher's surprise, milk. And for the Ernest Boys Academy, Monday, beef throats, smashed leg, hind quarter, gross livers, old-fashioned milk, cigars. Tuesday, flat motor pies, fisherman's regret, loin of fat, stunned ducks in alcohol sauce, milk. Wednesday, tart bottoms, slick fritters, breasts of toast, sweetbreads in hand, cuckoo punch, cigars, milk. Thursday, roast puffins, revenge pudding, pancakes in water, baked salad, ring of fire, milk. Friday, ducklings a la moron, smothered rodents, closet pie, turbo skeletons, champagne, brandies, cigars, milk. And for the Willie Loman Public High School, Monday, horse butter sandwiches, hot jello salad, French kisses, curb cake, milk. Tuesday, toads in a blanket in a hole, complicated salad, ice bread, Lomax pie, milk cocktail. Wednesday, hat with cheese, insurance salad, V6 bread, field surprise, milk. Thursday, battered vegetables, wax wrappers, wallet and raisin salad, adult milkshake. Friday, fried chuck, paper salad, responsibility pie, white dessert, retirement milk. And for the alternate current school, Monday, eco-veggie bar, rainbow crazy crunch, twig sticks, turkey straws, cow milk. Tuesday, helpless nuggets with sour sauce, gator tots, trial mix, white milk. Wednesday, false rabbit wedges, farm dip, sloppy Jones, birthday cake, goat milk. Thursday, meatless hot creatures, sweetened cherries, meltdown on a bun, squares, mother's milk. Friday, refried fries, early dismissal cup, hemp wheels, party on a bun, dip, sheep milk. And that concludes the Developmental Valley School District luncheon menus for this week.
Hey, Mom, why fuss and fret about dinner? Why not have it right here? Yes, a real picnic treat for dinner. We've got delicious sandwiches with all the trimmings and your other dinner favorites, plus whatever you want to drink, hot or cold. Yes, eat while you're being entertained. So why fuss?
Are you selling food at the fair? Nothing does so well to pair with many foods as a good hot square of cornbread. That's a quick bread made with baking powder instead of yeast, and it's made from a batter instead of dough. You can make it yourself easily in large pans and sell it to a happy and eager crowd. And this way, it's really popular.
Cornbread and honey butter. The best baking pan is a shiny, uncoated metal pan. These will give you a tender crumb and golden brown crust. This recipe is for a deep-walled, half-sheet-sized pan, 9 by 13 inches. You'll need 2.5 cups yellow cornmeal, 2 cups of flour, 1/2 cup of sugar, 2 tablespoons baking powder, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 cups of buttermilk, 2 large eggs, 1/2 cup melted butter. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees and grease your pan generously. Then mix the melted butter, buttermilk, and egg with a wire whisk in a deep mixing bowl until the result is fully combined. Stir in the dry ingredients just until everything is moistened, but a few lumps are fine. Overmixing this batter can lead to a dense or even tough result, so stop stirring as soon as the flour is fully incorporated. Since this quick bread relies on baking powder to rise, it should be baked immediately. Pour the thick batter into your pan and spread it evenly all the way to the corners with a spatula. Bake for 20 to 25 minutes until the top is golden brown and a toothpick inserted in the center comes out clean or with just a few moist crumbs. Start checking for doneness at the minimum bake time. It's ready when the top is golden brown and the sides pull away from the edges of the pan. Serve warm with honey butter. It goes well alone or with soup, chili, or beans. Honey butter is super simple to make. Start with softened butter and your honey butter will be ready in 5 minutes. Just leave 2 sticks of salted butter out at room temperature for an hour or longer. Use a hand mixer to combine them with 4 tablespoons of honey. Portion the result into small disposable cups and refrigerate so it stays stable over time. Supply a tiny wooden spoon to spread the butter.
On the episode webpage, you'll find a link to get any supplies you'll need, including the disposable cups and spoons.
It's refreshment time, and our refreshment stand is loaded with good things to eat. There's crispy, crunchy popcorn, and hot, delicious, buttered popcorn, lots of candy, and frosty, refreshing, cold drinks. Why not treat yourself at the refreshment center now?
Do you have experience in the fair or the carnival or the sideshow? Anything at all? Rides, game joints, magic, food, anything that brings customers to the lot with their money? If you do, then I want to talk to you. Email me at the address on this episode's webpage, ballycast.com, and share your story with listeners like you. See her right here with your own eyes, Aquamarina the Mermaid, the remarkable fish girl, the beauty who once drove sailors mad. Guaranteed to be absolutely real and alive, rescued from the wild and brought here for your wonder and amazement. See her right here in this little bowl, just the way she was born, ready to charm you like she charmed sailors out on the sea. This is a 1954 plan from Carnival legend Aaron Brill. Detailed instructions for building and decorating the girl in fishbowl illusion. They'll love it and want to love her, and they'll give you their dollars to see the girl apparently right inside her fishbowl. Costume her right and she doesn't even have to get wet. Get this PDF file emailed to you today. 3 pages of very detailed secrets, including illustrations that make everything clear for you. Easy to build and easy to cash in on. How it's done, how you sell it to the crowd, and why it will definitely make you money. Just $5. The link to get it is on this episode's webpage. I'll see you on the lot after you're back from the bank, and I'll see her right there in her little bowl. Well, the whole shebang today is tiring. I'm going to do the usual closing and then offer you a long tale from Carrie Fisher. Shame she's gone.
Ballycast is produced by Wayne Kaiser for Blue Ridge Entertainment under a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. That means you can keep it, copy it, share it with a friend, just tell them where it came from, don't change it, and don't sell it. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe at ballycast.com. Visit us, link to us, subscribe to the podcast, and most importantly, enjoy.
Thanks for riding. Please exit to your left.
It's getting hard to find. An abundance of apparently's. So I am 52 years old, apparently. Actually, that is more verifiable than the rest of it. I'd better start off with certainties. Here are the headlines. Head, in so many ways, being the operative word. I am 52 years old. I am Carrie Fisher. I have a daughter, Billy. I live in Los Angeles. I have two dogs. I have a really nice house. Carrie Fisher is apparently a celebrity of sorts. I mean, she's the daughter of famous parents, one an icon, the other a consort to icons. Actually, that's not completely fair. My father is a singer named Eddie Fisher, what was in the 50s called a crooner with many gold records. I only say my father is a consort because he's really better known for his not-so-private life than the life he lived on stage. His scandals outshone his celebrity. Or you might say that his scandals informed his celebrity in such a way as to make him infamous. My mother, Debbie Reynolds, was in what might be called iconic films, most notably Singing in the Rain. But for whatever reason, when my parents hooked up, it had an extraordinary impact on the masses who bought fan magazines. The media dubbed them America's Sweethearts. The idea of them electrified. Their pictures graced the covers of all the tabloids of the day. They were adorable, and as such were ogled by an army of eyes. So cute and cuddly, and in some ways adorably average. The Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston of the late 50s, only slightly more so, because they actually managed to procreate, making two tiny children to fill out the picture, or pictures, as the case turned out to be, an all-American and photogenic family. When I was younger, starting at about 4, other children would ask me what it was like to be a movie star's daughter. Once I was a little older and understood, to a certain extent, the nature of what celebrity meant, I would say, compared to what? When I wasn't a movie star's daughter? When I lived with my normal, non-show business family, the regulars, Patty and Lowell regular of Scottsdale, Arizona? All I've ever really known is this sort of hothouse plant existence, and I could tell from watching how normal people lived, normal people as depicted by Hollywood and burned into our consciousness, I understood that my life was unusual. Like many others, I grew up watching television shows like My Three Sons and The Partridge Family and The Real McCoys, and based on the lives depicted on those shows, I knew my life was a different sort of real. It was the only reality I knew, but compared to other folks, both on television and off, it eventually struck me as a little surreal, too. And eventually, too, I understood that my version of reality had a tendency to set me apart from others. And when you're young, you want to fit in. Hell, I still want to fit in with certain humans, but as you get older, you get a little more discriminating. Well, my parents were professionally committed to sticking out. So all too frequently, I found myself sticking out right along with them. Now, I'm certainly not asking anyone to feel bad for me or suggest that my existence could be described as a predicament of some kind. I'm simply describing the dynamic that was at work during my formative years. My parents were focus pullers, and when I say parents, I mean my mother, who raised me, and my father, who checked in from time to time. I mean, if I came into a room and said, "You know how you saw your father more on TV than you did in real life?" I don't think many people would say, "Oh my God, you too?" And by the same token, I have to ask you, how often do you say "in real life"? Like, real life is this other thing, and we're always trying to determine what's going on in this distant, inaccessible, incomprehensible place. What are they like in real life? That happened in real life? Really? Stuff like that. I am truly a product of Hollywood. You might say that I'm a product of Hollywood inbreeding. When two celebrities mate, something like me is the result. I grew up visiting sets and playing on backlots and watching movies being made. As a consequence, I find that I don't have what could be considered a conventional sense of reality. Not that I've ever had much use for reality, having spent much of my adult life attempting to escape it with the assistance of a variety of drugs. So as I said, my reality has been formed by Hollywood's version of reality. As a child, I thought that Father Knows Best was real and that my life was fake. When I think about it now, I may not have been far wrong. I tell you all of this as a newly made bystander, as I have been reintroduced into my world by electroconvulsive therapy, more commonly known as ECT, for those oh so fortunately familiar with it, and electroshock for those who are not. I've been reintroduced to my life at the ripe old age of 52. My memory, especially my visual memory, has been wrenched from me. All of a sudden, I find that I seem to have forgotten who I was before. So I need to reacquaint myself with this sort of celebrity person I seem to be. Someone who was in an iconic blockbuster film called Star Wars. How trippy is that? One thing I do recall is that one day, when I was a toddler, I sat planted closely to the television set, watching my mother in a movie called Susan Slept Here. And at a certain point, there's this scene where my very young mother tilts her face up to receive a kiss from Dick Powell. A kiss on the mouth, a romantic kiss. So she has her eyes closed, waiting. But instead of kissing her on the mouth, Mr. Powell bends down and kisses her on the forehead. And I sit there, registering this, and then look quickly over my shoulder to see if anyone else had seen what I saw, to see if I should be more embarrassed for my mother than I already was. I tell you this to illustrate that many times I didn't know the difference between movies and real life. In my life, they tend to overlap. Cary Grant, yes, the Cary Grant, became a family friend, even though he wasn't precisely that. And characters that my mother played in movies sometimes became confused with the person who was and is my mother. So, in a way, movies became home movies. Home became just another place on the movie star map. Later on, I worked out that my mother's appearance in the classic film Singing in the Rain was not completely unlike my own appearance in Star Wars. See, when she made that film, she was 19 and co-starred with two men. Well, I was also 19 when I made Star Wars and appeared opposite two men. How this is relevant, I have really no idea. I mean, maybe I was just grasping around for a sense of continuity. I emerge from my 3-week-long ECT treatment to discover that I am not only this Princess Leia creature, but also several sizes of dolls, various t-shirts and posters, some cleansing items, and a bunch of other merchandise. It turns out, I swear, I was actually a kind of a pinup, a fantasy that geeky teenage boys across the globe jerked off to with some frequency. How's that for a newborn how-do-you-do damsel in very little cinematic distress? To wit, one afternoon in Berkeley, I found myself walking into a shop that sold rocks and gems. "Oh my God, aren't you?" the salesman behind the counter began. And before he could go any further, I modestly said, "Yes, I am." "Oh my God, I thought of you every day from when I was 12 to when I was 22, he said. And instead of asking what happened at 22, I said, "Every day?" He shrugged and said, "Well, 4 times a day. Welcome to the land of way too much information. On top of all this celebrity parents and Star Wars stuff, I apparently was once married to this brilliant songwriter, a rock icon of sorts. I mean, this is a man who wrote an array of beautiful songs, and even a few songs that were about me. How amazing is that? And get this, I'd always been a really big fan of his music. Huge. As a teen, it was just him and Joni Mitchell. And as I couldn't marry Joni, I married him. I loved this man's lyrics. They were one of the reasons I fell in love with words. I mean, how can you not love someone who writes, "Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the baboon heart." Well, the answer for me was I couldn't. I couldn't not love him. I apprenticed myself to the best in him and bickered with the worst. And to top it off, we were almost the same size. I used to say to him, "Don't stand next to me at the party. People will think we're salt and pepper shakers." And wait till you hear this one. I've written 4 novels. Seriously. And 2 of them were even bestsellers. My first novel, Postcards from the Edge, was adapted into a film directed by Mike Nichols and starring Shirley MacLaine and Meryl Streep, basically playing a sometimes better, sometimes worse, dolled-up version of my mother and myself. I could go on and on, because there are certainly a lot of other cool things. I mean, the coolest being that I'm the mother of this amazing daughter named Billy. She's actually my most extraordinary creation. It occurs to me I might sound as though I'm boasting, and I promise you I'm not. It's just that ECT has forced me to rediscover what amounts to the sum total of my life. And, you know, I find a hell of a lot of it fills me with this kind of giddy gratitude. I mean, some of my memories will never return. They are completely lost, along with the crippling feeling of defeat and hopelessness. Not a tremendous price to pay when you think about it. Worth it! But now that we've established that I've had ECT, I have a list that I thought I'd share. A list of the electroshock treatment gang who have also apparently benefited from ECT. They may not have benefited from it, but they had it. I do this because I find that I frequently feel better about myself when I discover that we're not alone, you know, that there are, in fact, a number of other people who ail as we do, that there are actually a number of accomplished individuals who find it necessary to seek treatment for some otherwise insurmountable inner unpleasantness. I not only feel better about myself because these people are also fucked up, and I guess that gives us a kind of sense of extended community, but I feel better because look how much these fellow fuck-ups managed to accomplish. So, here are a portion of the folks with whom I share Electro Company. Judy Garland, Bill Styron, Sylvia Plath, Cole Porter, Lou Reed, Vivian Leigh, Yves Saint Laurent, Connie Francis, Ernest Hemingway, Dick Cavett, Kitty Dukakis. I should also add that a lot of these people also show up in the Alcohol Addict lineup and Bipolar Crew, giving some of these multi-listers and myself the admirable distinction of having a trifecta score. Now, these fine folks are Bill Styron, Vivian Leigh, Frances Farmer, Sylvia Plath, Ernest Hemingway, Dick Cavett, Kitty Dukakis, Yves Saint Laurent, and Cole Porter. Why did I feel I needed ECT? Well, it had been recommended by several psychiatrists over the years to treat my depression, but I couldn't bring myself to consider it as it seemed way too barbaric. My only exposure to it was Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which wasn't exactly an enticing example. From the seizures to the biting down on the stick to the convulsions, it looked traumatic, dangerous, and humiliating. I mean, what do we know for certain about it, right? Aren't there a bunch of risks? What if something goes wrong and my brain blows up? I'd been feeling pretty overwhelmed and defeated. I didn't necessarily feel like dying, but I'd been feeling a lot like not being alive. The second reason I decided to get ECT is I was depressed. I mean, profoundly depressed. Part of this could be attributed to my mood disorder, which was, in no doubt, probably the source of the emotional intensity. I mean, that's what can take simple sadness and turn it into sadness squared, right? It's sort of what revs up the motor of misery, guns the engine of an unpleasant experience, filling it with rocket fuel and blasting it into a place in the stratosphere that is oh so near something like a suicidal tendency. A place where the wish to continue living in this painful way is all but completely absent. So, when weighing the choice between ECT or DOA, the decision's pretty easy to make. Not only because of my daughter and the rest of my family, but for my formerly higher-functioning self. In the end, the choice couldn't have been easier to make. Electricity as opposed to game over. I decided to ride the lightning instead of extinguishing the light of life that had once shone out of my eyes. I keep my wick lit for my daughter, Billy, for my mother, my brother, for my entire family, and for each friend I've made with both hands, one heart, two moods, and a head once crammed with memory. Memory I must now reacquaint myself with. Perhaps now is as good a time as any to share with you the message that currently greets all callers on my answering machine, crafted by my friend Garrett. Hello, and welcome to Carrie's voicemail. Due to recent electroconvulsive therapy, please pay close attention to the following options. Leave your name, number, and brief history as to how Carrie knows you, and she'll get back to you if this jogs what's left of her memory. Thank you for calling, and have a great day. Each night, I do a show where I entertain with tales of my dysfunction. I've done the same show dozens of times in an assortment of cities, yet somehow, depending on the audience, it's always a little different. Adding myself to the dearth of damaged celebrities that seem compelled to share their tales of their time spent circling the drain. Wishful Drinking, both the show and the book, chronicles my all-too-eventful and, by necessity, amusing, Leia-laden life. I tell this story partly as a means to reclaim whatever I can of my former life, what hasn't been eaten by electroconvulsive therapy, and partly because I heard someone once say that we're only as sick as our secrets. If that's true, then this book will go a long way to rendering me amazingly well. Shores of experience, both dark and unfriendly. I have to start by telling you that my entire existence could be summed up in one phrase, And that is, if my life wasn't funny, it would just be true. And that is unacceptable. What that means is, well, other than what it sounds like, let's say something happens, and from a certain slant, maybe it's tragic, even a little bit shocking. Then time passes, and you go to the funny slant. And now, that very same thing can no longer do you any harm. So what we're really talking about then is location, location, location. An example of the tragic and shocking might be, 3 years ago, 10 months and 9 days, a friend of mine died in my house. But, not content to simply die at my house, he also died in my bed. So, he didn't just die in his sleep, he died in mine. Greg was one of my best friends, and he wasn't my boyfriend or anything. I mean, he didn't die in the saddle, which would have made me the saddle. No, Greg was gay, which could turn out to be something of a theme in this book. Now, if you entertain like I do, try to alert your guests not to do this. For two reasons, really. A, it's bad manners. And B, it tends to throw the host, or hostess, off their game a little bit. Like for a year or three. Now, I assume there might be some curiosity about this fairly exotic experience. And I know we don't know each other that well yet, but I promise you that's going to change drastically until some of you might actually feel the need to divorce me. And for that reason, we have lawyers standing by. But I promise you, you're not getting a dime. Or maybe you're not curious about this because you've woken up next to a corpse and therefore already know a lot more than anyone could possibly ever want to know about it. That, or maybe you don't want to know what it's like at all. I mean, it sounds unsavory and distasteful enough without the details. So, why dig deeper, you ask? I've actually found that a lot of people are curious about this whole business of a man dying in my bed. One of my favorite questions an audience member has asked me was, "How did you dispose of the body?" As if I dug a hole, put Greg in a bag, dragged him outside, and, well, you get the overall gist of my drift. Another favorite question is, were you naked? I haven't been naked in 15 years, and I haven't gone sleeveless in 20. Of course, sometimes people ask sensible questions like, what was he doing in your bed? Which is when I get to say, not much. But when they phrase it the other way, like, why was he in your bed, I'm forced to reply honestly. I tell them that it was Oscar time in Los Angeles, which is sort of like New Year's Eve for the vapid. And as my home is one of the centers of vapidity on the West Coast, Greg had flown out to L.A. to accompany me to the parties. He'd flown in from Bosnia, where he'd been running a presidential campaign. Because that's what Greg did. He ran presidential campaigns in unstable countries, like Republicans like to do. So he and his assistant Judy flew in to stay with me. Judy slept in the guest house, and I had another female friend who was gay also staying with us. So I had a choice, sleep with the gay male friend or the gay female friend. I picked the gay male friend, and I was punished for it. I will never, ever do that again. Now, I've also been asked, what the hell was I doing in bed with a Republican? And in order to demonstrate my loyalty to the Democratic Party, I sometimes tell people that I may have slept with the Republican, but I've actually had sex with a Democratic senator. Of course, I'm then asked which senator, to which I reply, Chris Dodd. And the only reason I feel at liberty to blab about this indiscretion is that Senator Dodd spoke of our courtship that we engaged in those many thousands of years ago recently during his bid for the presidency. So when asked to elaborate on our courtship, Senator Dodd coyly replied, "Well, it was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away." I believe it was largely this comment that was responsible for his failure to win the nomination. You might also be wondering what caused Gregg's death, other than his being a Republican. So I'll tell you. He died from a combination of sleep apnea. You know what that is, where you're maybe a little overweight and you sleep on your back and you're snoring and you suddenly stop breathing, right? It's kind of like you drown. So he died from sleep apnea and OxyContin use. Now, if you don't know what OxyContin is, it is a very strong painkiller that has the nickname OxyCoffin. But Gregg wasn't just a Republican like a person who votes to the right. No, he was a Republican kind of like I was Princess Leia. He was a Republican by profession. Because how many gay Republican drug users do you know? Oh, that's right. Lots and lots. But Gregg was really in on the ground floor of the whole gay Republican movement that's so prevalent in Washington today. The fact of the matter is, Gregg was a lot of fun, especially for a Republican, and he had great stories. I mean, this is a guy who actually shared an office with Bush. But a long time ago, when W was just George Sr.'s son. So the two of them shared this little office. And Gregg once told me, you know what Bush has as one of his many, many gifts? He can fart on command. Which is actually, if you think about it, in keeping with his jolly college good old frat boy persona. And Gregg said that what Bush used to do was when Gregg would be expecting a few people for a meeting, W would come in, fart in the office, and then run, leaving Gregg in the middle of it. You know, like someone in a cloud of bad marijuana smoke. So the people Gregg was meeting with would then come in and, of course, assume Gregg was the author of this awful smell. It's not dissimilar to what President Bush has done to the country. At the time of Gregg's death, my friend Dave said to me, "Honey, I know this is all just a gigantic pain in the ass." And I said, "If I could isolate the pain just to my ass, it would be awesome." And Dave said, "Well, that's the meditation then." You know what's funny about death? I mean, other than absolutely nothing at all. You would think that we would be able to remember finding out that we weren't immortal. You know, sometimes I see children sobbing in airports, and I think, oh, they've just been told. But no, we gradually somehow just seem to have been able to absorb the blow. Blow, not being the operative word, Gregg did do quite a bit of that, just not on this particular evening. Anyway, enough about death. I just wanted to get that bummer story out of the way at the top of the book. It's over now. All the rest of my stories are fun and laughs and skipping. Scandal outshining celebrity. So now, will you guys come on a journey with me? Okay? We're going to start at death, but then we're going to double back. And we're going to go all the way through an emergency room where they know me, through Watergate, through Vietnam, to birth. My birth. I was born on October 21st, 1956. This makes me quite old, half a century and change. And I was born in Burbank, California. To simple folk. People of the land. No, actually, my father was a famous singer. And you want to hear something really cool? My mother's a movie star. Seriously. She's like an icon. A gay icon, but, you know, you take your iconic stature where you can get it. His name is Eddie Fisher, and her name is Debbie Reynolds. Now, my parents had this incredibly vital relationship with an audience. You know, like with muscle and blood. And this was the main competition that I had for my parents' attention. An audience. People like you. You know who you are. My father had many big hit songs, but perhaps the one he's best remembered for was the song Oh My Papa, which I like to call Oh My Faux Pas. And my mother, well, she did tons and tons of films, but I think maybe the one she's best remembered for is the classic film Singing in the Rain. But she was also nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress for her role in The Unsinkable Molly Brown. But tragically, she lost to Julie Andrews for her stunning, layered, and moving portrait of Mary Poppins. Ibsen's Mary Poppins, of course. My mother was also in another film called Tammy, which was also a hit song, which really pissed my father off because that was his area. She was actually pregnant with me when she filmed Tammy. So if you look very closely, there's a scene where she and Leslie Nielsen are trying to save some prized tomatoes in a rainstorm, like they do in old movies. Well, I'm the bulge in the side of her abdomen. It's some of my best screen work, so I urge you to see it. Oh, and she was also pregnant with me in yet another film called A Bundle of Joy, co-starring that marvelous method actor, Eddie Fisher. When I was born, my mother was given anesthesia, because they didn't have epidurals in those days. I always thought they should make epidurals that worked from the neck up, which was a condition I aspired to for most of what I laughingly refer to as my adult life. Anyway, so my mother was unconscious. Now, my mother is a beautiful woman. I mean, she's beautiful today in her 70s, so at 24, she looked like a Christmas morning. So all the doctors were buzzing around her pretty head, going, oh, look, there's Debbie Reynolds, how pretty, asleep. And my father, upon seeing me start to come through, you know, crowned with all the placenta and everything else, ugh, my father faints dead away. So now all the nurses go, oh, look, there's Eddie Fisher, the crooner on the ground. Let's go look at him. So when I arrived, I was virtually unattended. And I have been trying to make up for that fact ever since. Even this book is a pathetic bid for the attention I lacked as a newborn. My father was best friends with a very charismatic producer named Mike Todd. Mike Todd produced a film called Around the World in 80 Days, which won an Oscar for Best Picture. So my father and mother, Mike Todd, his fiancée, who happened to be Elizabeth Taylor, they went everywhere together, you know. They went to nightclubs and on cruises. They literally traveled the world. So when Mike and Elizabeth got married, my father was Mike Todd's best man, and my mother was Elizabeth's matron of honor. She even washed her hair on her wedding day. Now, later I heard my mother mumble she wished she'd washed it with Nair, but she's not a bitter woman. Anyway, I was about 2 when my brother was born, and my father so adored Mike Todd that my brother Todd was named for him. Now, perhaps not realizing that in the Jewish faith, it is considered bad luck to name a newborn after someone who is still living. A silly superstition, or so they thought. Because about a year later, Mike Todd took off in a private plane in a rainstorm, and the following morning, Elizabeth was a widow. Well, naturally, my father flew to Elizabeth's side, gradually making his way slowly to her front. He first dried her eyes with his handkerchief, and then consoled her with flowers, and ultimately he consoled her with his penis. Now this made marriage to my mother awkward, so he was gone within the week, and as far as I know, he has not returned, up to this very day. But you know what? I have high hopes for the run of my show, because I think one night they're both going to come to the show on the same night, run into each other, get that old feeling, get back together, and raise me right. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, that explains it. She's the product of Hollywood inbreeding. That's why my skull isn't entirely grown together at the back. Recently, my daughter Billy, who's 16 now, she had a flirtation with Mike Todd and Elizabeth's grandson, Reese. And when they first met, they were trying to work out how it all fit together, you know, and if they were related in any way. So I thought about it. Now, when I think, I need this enormous chalkboard with a chart to hold my thoughts because I have so many zooming this way and that. And then it's also helpful if I can have some pictures and a pen so I can organize the insanity that is my thought process and my family. Welcome, class, to Hollywood 101. Thank you so much for enrolling. All right, so over here at the top left of the chart, we have Eddie and Debbie. In the 50s, they were known as America's sweethearts. Now, for those of you that are too young to relate to any of this, try to think of it this way. Think of Eddie as Brad Pitt, Debbie as Jennifer Aniston, and Elizabeth as Angelina Jolie. Does that help? That should help. All right. So, Eddie consoles Elizabeth with his penis. Elizabeth takes a movie in Rome, big budget film called Cleopatra. She meets her co-star, Richard Burton. So, goodbye, Eddie. Hello, Richard. These two hit it off like gangbusters, whatever that means. And they met and they married. They had a wild, passionate relationship with violet eyes and Welsh accents and acting and diamonds and drinking and dancing and sex and joy and love. But it was a passionate relationship, and those can become stormy. So then what do you think happens? That's right. They get divorced. But they have good memories of each other. So what do you think they do then? They remarry. That's right. Now, keep that in mind, because it might come up again. All right, so now let's go to Debbie. Now, Debbie does not want to marry another man who'll just run off. So, she marries someone very, very old, who can't run. Nope, Harry Carl can't run at all. He just sits in a chair, and he smokes, and he drinks, and reads the paper. And after about 13 years, he loses all his money, and then he takes all of hers. Fun! And so they got divorced, and she was alone for a while. But then fate intervened and brought her this sociopath, Richard Hamlet, who also had money issues. Her money. But let's not get too far past stepfather number one, Harry Carl. Now, Harry was a shoe tycoon. Doesn't sound like those words should fit together, does it? But in this case, they do. So, prior to being married to my mother, Harry was married to Marie MacDonald. Marie the Body MacDonald, as she was known. Now, Marie was an actress-ish. And she and Harry met, and they married, and they had a wild, passionate relationship with shoes and bodies and drinking and dancing and lust and joy and fun. But here come those storm clouds, so what do you think they do then? Yep, that's right, they divorce. But they have good memories of each other, so now what do? That's right, they remarry! And now they had that great American institution. They have makeup sex, which, as everyone knows, is the best sex of all. And to celebrate the good sex, they do it in the usual way. They have a child. And that goes so well, they adopt two more. But, uh-oh, here come those storm clouds. So they... yep, they divorce. Now, Marie MacDonald was a very romantic, optimistic woman, And I say this because she married a grand total of 9 times, which is a record for the board, and that is saying something because this is a marrying board. Now, that many marriages could give you a headache, no? Well, I think it gave Marie one, because she became addicted to painkillers. Now, recently, I heard this amazing thing. If you become addicted to painkillers, it can turn out to go very, very wrong for you. Who knew that? Anyway, it did go wrong with Marie because she ended up overdosing and passing on, and that last husband, not to be outdone, shot himself. You might say they loved each other to death. So, now there are these 3 children left. What should we do with them? I know. Let's send them to Harry and Debbie. Now, Debbie is told that one of these children should be institutionalized. But my mother is a good person, much like Sarah Palin, only smarter. And she says, absolutely not. We will put the institutionalizable one in Carrie's room. Sure, it's funny now. So now let's go to Eddie. Poor Eddie. How do you follow an act like Elizabeth Taylor? Well, he manages somehow. He pulls something together. He meets a blonde, cute, perky little actress. Sound familiar? No, it's not Debbie again. It's a tribute to Debbie. It's Connie Stevens. So they meet, and they have Jolie Fisher from the sitcom Till Death and Trisha Fisher from New York. Oh, wait a second. Did Eddie forget to marry Connie? He did. He forgot to marry her. But eventually he remembers, so they get married. But, as many, many people know, legal sex is just shite compared to the premarital stuff that I know so many couples have had in cars. So, they divorce. But don't worry, Eddie's not alone for long, because now he meets and marries Miss Louisiana! Yes, she's 3 years older than I am, and she calls me dear, which I love. I love it. Now, I thought this relationship would go on and on and on because, you know, Miss Louisiana's in her early 20s, and Eddie's in his late 50s, so she had so many years to devote to him. But what do you think happens? Yep, they divorce. I was stunned. But don't worry, he's not alone for long, because now he meets and marries this really lovely woman named Betty Lin. Betty is from China, and she takes fantastic care of my father, and believe me, he needs it. And she's the same age as Eddie, which hasn't happened since the Debbie and Liz stuff. And the other good thing about Betty is that she's rich. Which is handy because Eddie's gone bankrupt 4 times by now. So they're happy for 10, 15 glorious years. But then what do you think happens? That one's actually a trick question because they don't divorce. Betty passes away. It was sad. But don't worry. He's not alone for long. Because now my father dates all of Chinatown. He does this partly as a tribute to Betty, partly because my father has had so many facelifts that he looks Asian himself. So it's more right that way. You know, they're more like a match set. Okay, so now let's recap. Eddie and Debbie have me and my brother Todd. I grow up, sort of, and I marry Paul Simon. Now, Paul is a short Jewish singer, and Eddie Fisher is a short Jewish singer. Any questions? My mother makes a blueprint, and I follow it to the letter. So Paul and I have a passionate relationship with lots of words, big words, clever words. Uh-oh, the words get mean. So now we get divorced. But don't worry, I'm not alone for long, because now I meet Brian Lord. Brian is a talent agent, so fewer words, great sex, we celebrate and we have a child together, Billy Lord. Elizabeth and Mike Todd have Liza Todd. Liza is a wonderful sculptress, and she meets and marries her art professor, Professor Hap Tivy. Hap is short for happy, so he's not Jewish. Anyway, they have Quinn Tivy and Reese Tivy. So, Reese Tivy and Billy Lord. Are they related? You can peek back at the chart if you haven't already. I told them, you're related by scandal. I just hope the two of them marry someday so all this will be worthwhile. And that is Hollywood inbreeding. Hollywood inbreeding is a little like royal inbreeding. And after all, celebrity is sort of like American royalty. So my brother and I are like those sad, sad royal inbred cases, like King Charles II of Spain, the last of the Habsburgs. Charles, now this man was so horribly inbred that his aunt was also his grandmother. And his tongue was so large that he couldn't chew, couldn't be understood, and he drooled. Another little challenge for Charles was that his organs were dying inside his body. The one on the outside didn't work that well either, because he died childless. But because his organs were dying, he smelled. So the people around him would put this perfume on him when he met prospective wives. And by the way, we do sell that perfume out in the lobby at my show. Now, another issue for Charles was he had these little seizures all the time, and he would fall over. So the perfume people put weights in his shoes. Anyway, it worked, because Charles actually managed to marry twice. Probably someone with nursing ambitions, which goes to show you that there is a lid for every pot. Sometimes there's as many as 9 lids for the same pot. Also, when I was a teenager, you could buy pot in lids. But I don't think you can anymore, can you? Oh, and Charles's death caused the War of the Spanish Succession, which I know a lot of you have been discussing at length recently. So my brother and I grew up smelling and drooling and having seizures, and we did all this in our house, which I called the embassy, because really it looks a lot less like a house than a place where you'd get your passport stamped. Where would you put a Christmas wreath on something like that? So it was a modern house, and it had things most normal houses don't have. For example, we had 8 little pink refrigerators, you know, in case Snow White and the 7 dwarves came by. And we had a lanai and utility closets. And we had 3 pools, you know, in case 2 broke. Now, there was also my mother's closet, which I always thought of as the Church of Latter-day Debbie. There was a certain hush, a certain smell of Abilene cream and White Shoulders perfume. It was very, very dark and very quiet, and it was subject to its own laws, sort of like the phone booth where Clark Kent was transformed into Superman. My mother's closet was the magical place that she entered as my mom and emerged as Debbie Reynolds. Her closet was huge, like an enormous room, with an entrance and an exit, and it was lined on each side by every sort of clothes. Gowns, slacks, blouses, shoes, and hat boxes, all manner of attire imaginable, and even the unimaginable. I remember she had all these long, pale gowns made out of beads. One in particular was this blue gown that shimmered with blue beads, and it even had blue fur on the sleeves and on the hem, So she'd float through a room in these movie star gowns. Then there was this long, shimmery white chest of drawers where she kept all of her underwear and bras and slips and stockings, all neatly folded up and smelling of sachet. She had this weird giant underwear that went over her belly button, big underpants and huge bras. I remember thinking, oh, wow, someday when I'm grown up, maybe I'll get my own enormously big breasts. I used to watch while my mother lifted up her huge fun bag so she could wash underneath them. Eventually, I actually did get those big breasts, and now I am truly, truly sorry. My mother's closet wasn't off limits, but it was very much hers, and therefore my younger brother Todd and I valued it. It was prized because of how highly we prized our mother. She was often away, and when we missed her, we could go into her closet and put our faces into a bunch of clothes and inhale the powdery, flowery scent of her. We would put shows on together in the closet, making some kind of airplane game or restaurant game. And then there was this hat that we for some reason called the bum-bum hat. It was this giant straw hat with a brim that continued on over your eyes so you could look out of this green mesh. We loved nothing more than to put on the bum-bum hat and look through the green mesh at our suddenly transformed surroundings. My mother was magnificent when she was decked out in all her glory, when she was ablaze with all manner of jewelry and gems and shimmering diamond earrings and her neck encircled with bright stones that caught the light, and a gown with matching shoes and stockings and makeup, and her tall wig carefully coiffed by her hairdresser Sidney Gilleroff, or Uncle Sidney, as we were encouraged to call him. Sidney's name could be found in the credits of some of the more classic MGM films of all time. My mother would emerge from her dressing room a vision, so glamorous and so not of this world. When my mom was home on weekends, we stayed with her as much as possible, which frequently meant that we were very involved in watching our mother. Right next to her closet, there was this huge bathroom with magenta marble and mirrors everywhere. And I remember the smells of her perfume, the L'Air du Temps or the creams like Pons or Abilene. And on the bathtub, there were always two or three monogrammed face cloths laid out with her initials. DRK, Debbie Reynolds Carl. And then there was the Shrine of the Wigs, which was at the end of one countertop, along with what seemed to me like hundreds and hundreds of lipsticks, eyebrow pencils, and false eyelashes. My mother was unbelievably meticulous at all of this. She would twirl her hair up into pin curls that she'd use to pull her face tighter. Then she'd put on her makeup base with a sponge. The base went really low when the dress was low cut, which it often was. Then she applied false eyelashes. So she didn't need mascara, but there was a lot of eyeliner. Next came lipstick and rouge and powder, great puffs of glittering clouds of powder, followed by hair, which was a big deal getting the wig on right. Then came the earrings. And then she'd step into her clothes. Then came her stockings and her tiny little size 5 shoes. When she was completely finished, her Debbie Reynolds movie star accent got stronger, her posture got better, and she looked incredibly beautiful. When our mother dressed, the man behind the curtain became the great and powerful Oz. Undressing was also a process my brother and I observed. First, we'd watch my mother as she removed her makeup with a washcloth. Then she'd take a bubble bath. As Todd and I looked on, Debbie Reynolds would slowly return to being our mother. The coach was once more a pumpkin. The footman went back to being mice. Pinocchio became a real girl. We loved to be with her when she resumed her role as our mother. That this amazing being, who looked like she looked and had these remarkable abilities, belonged to us somehow. She was so beautiful, and, of course, I dreamt of one day looking like her. I fantasized that perhaps if Uncle Sidney would put my mother's tall golden wig on my head and give me her perfectly coiffed hairstyle, then I would transform into the confident, in shining beauty I would surely be. Soon I would be beautiful too. But to my horror, no such transformation occurred. It was then that I knew with the profound certainty of a 10-year-old that I would not be, and was in no way now, the beauty that my mother was. I was a clumsy-looking and intensely awkward, insecure girl. I decided then that I'd better develop something else. If I wasn't going to be pretty, maybe I could be funny or smart. Someone past caring. So far past caring that you couldn't even see it with a telescope. Sometimes my mother would take me shopping, to Saks Fifth Avenue, or a store called Pixie Town. But when I was a little girl, and even sometimes now, it was complicated to go out in public with my mother because she was so famous. She belonged to the world. She not only looked like Debbie Reynolds, but to make matters worse, she wore this giant diamond ring. It was like being in a parade. In a way, my mother was an event. "Oh, my God," people would say to her, "I loved you in Molly Brown," or "I saw you in Vegas." So it was not like having private time with Mom. And I really didn't like sharing her. It seemed almost unsanitary. When my mother was home, she did a lot of sleeping because she worked so hard and had such long hours. So Todd and I wanted as much of her company as we could get. I slept on the rug on the floor next to her bed, and my brother slept on the couch near the window. In the morning, when Todd and I got up, we would creep softly out of her room so we wouldn't wake her. Our house was very cold, with lots of marble and white couches that were all puffed up, and glass coffee tables and white rugs with plastic on the corners to protect them. Everywhere were things we could ruin, so we didn't want to screw up and make the puffed-up couch deflate or leave marks on the glass tabletops. It was complicated to find a groovy place to hang out in. We usually ended up hanging out in the kitchen. That's where it felt the homiest. Now, my stepfather, Harry Carl, was not a handsome man. But because he was wealthy and well-groomed, he was said to be distinguished-looking. That's ugly with money. They actually made a movie about Harry Carl and Marie McDonald and their multiple marriages. It was called The Marrying Man. And Alec Baldwin played Harry Carl. And I think the resemblance is astonishing. Harry had his own room with a closet that was pristine and beige. We had a laundress named Letha who came in once a week to do Harry's shirts. His shirts were monogrammed, and he also had monogrammed slippers and silk paisley pajama tops and a lot of neat gray suits. There was one of those black and red things that twirl around and shine your shoes, and a secret drawer to hide his gold coins, and a wooden coat rack to put his jackets on. He also had a man named Phil Kaplan, who helped him dress. And then there was a barber and manicurist who came in to help him get distinguished looking. But the most unique room we had was on the way to the projection room. It was sort of like an exercise room, But what stopped it from being an exercise room was that it had a barber chair in the middle of it. We found out later that the barber who came every day turned out to be a pimp with a talent for hair, and for those of you with pimps, you know that they usually can't do hair for shit. So the manicures that the barber brought with him every day, they were probably doing more of a French manicure, don't you think? The word hangnail comes to mind. My mother, on the other hand, did everything for herself. She was an incredibly energetic human and could be unbelievably fun. Harry, though, was not fun. Not deliberately, anyway. But he did get out of bed wearing just pajama tops so that the back of his penis was proudly displayed. And to top it off, he farted a lot, thus becoming a subject of great hilarity for my brother and me. We used to bring our friends over for a tour of the house, and if Harry was home, there were always great gales of laughter. Anyway, the whole manicurist thing made marriage to my mother awkward, coupled with the taking of all her money. So she took a musical in New York to get out of the marriage, which, in Hollywood, is a legal way to dissolve a union without involving lawyers. So when I was about 16, my mother took me out of high school and moved my brother and myself to New York for the year, and she put me in the chorus of her show. I don't care what you've heard, chorus work is far more valuable to a child than any education could ever be. I grew up knowing that I had the prettiest mother of anyone in my class. As long as I was in class, even after, though, she was the funniest, the prettiest, the kindest, most talented. I had the only tap dancing mother. In New York, we all lived on a nice little street on the Upper West Side, sandwiched conveniently between a music school and a funeral home. Anyway, on one particular evening, I was out on the town with some of the other kids from the chorus of the show, trying my best to be very grown up, as they were all at least 10 years older than I was. Well, somehow my mother knew what restaurant or club we were all at, so at about 10 or 10:30, someone comes and tells me my mother's on the phone. Well, I'm not thrilled to have my hijinks interrupted by my mommy, reminding everyone that I'm far younger than they are and not to be taken seriously. Shit. So I grumble through the people and tables, making my way to the waiting phone. Yeah, Mom, hey, could I talk to you she interrupts me. I'm at the hospital with your brother. He shot himself in the leg with a blank. What? I say. He'll be fine, dear, she continues. He's in surgery now, and they're cleaning the gunpowder out of the wound. He's very lucky. A few inches up, and he could have blown his penis off. Dear, please, language. Anyway, the police are here, and they want to come to the house to examine the gun. Apparently, if it can shoot blanks, though I don't know, they're saying it might be an unregistered firearm or unlicensed something, I don't know. Anyway, where was I? The police, I remind her. Oh, yes. Now, dear, I need you and Pinky. My mother's hairdresser's name was naturally Pinky. I need you to get to the house before the police to let them in. But I also need you to go through the house and hide all the guns and bullets and what else? Oh, yes, I need you to flush your brother's marijuana down the toilet. So you think you can do this, dear? Let me talk to Pinky. Well, this part was kind of thrilling, I have to say. Who knew we had bullets and guns in the house? Granted, they were my stepfather's show guns that he wore ridiculously in some Christmas parade some years back. But it turned out it was considered a firearm. We were suddenly more like a mafia family than a show business one. So Pinky and I rush back to our townhouse, and hide the guns and bullets in the washing machine. They'll never look there. And we sadly flush an enormous plastic bag with almost an entire lid of particularly pungent pot. Then I go out to check the scene of the crime, my mother's bedroom, where the shooting had occurred. And I have to say, it was quite something to behold. There are flecks of blood all over the walls and a considerable amount of blood on the bed. A sheet had been shredded in an effort to make a tourniquet. Wow, this was truly drama, and it was happening in real life, of all places. My real life, surreal as it all too frequently became when I was living with my show business family and not the regulars of Scottsdale. But if I thought it was surreal at this point, it was about to get a whole lot surrealer. I know, that's not an actual word. So, now it's Saturday night in New York. You would normally think that this wouldn't be a particularly slow night for crime in New York. But you wouldn't know it by our living room, because we've got 5 homicide policemen milling around, asking my mother pertinent questions about the crime, like, did you know John Wayne? What kind of guy was he? Finally, they tell us, after examining the weapon in question that my brother used in commission of the crime of shooting himself in the leg with a blank, the 5 policemen establish that said gun could actually discharge live ammo, and as such, actual bullets. What all this means is that my mother is in possession of an unlicensed firearm and needs to come down to the local precinct where she would be officially booked for possession of a firearm. So now it's about 4 a.m., and my mother and I are taken down to the police station for her mugshot and to be fingerprinted along with the rest of the hookers and dope fiends and murderers and thieves. So by the time we get home, it's close to 6. And my mother and I are at the kitchen table, totally exhausted. Suddenly, there's a knock at the door. And we look at each other. Well, who could that possibly be at this hour? My mother gets up to see while I wait nervously. When she returns, she's laughing. What? I ask. Who was it? It was a couple of reporters, she explains, catching her breath. They heard Todd had been shot in the leg, and they wanted to know if I had done it for publicity for the show. You know, to drum up additional ticket sales. I so badly wanted to tell them yes, and now I can only do one more Broadway musical, because I only have one child left to shoot for publicity. It's almost dawn, and we're both so tired by now that we're a little punchy, so we begin to invent other reasons why my mother might have shot my brother. We come up with everything from he wouldn't clean his bedroom, to he stopped feeding his turtle, to his grades were down. All perfectly credible as far as we were concerned. The next day, there's a photograph of my brother in the hospital with my mother in a mink hat smiling beside him on the front page of the Daily News. The headline read, Picasso Dies. Now, one detail I neglected to mention is that right after the gun discharged the blank into my brother's upper thigh, my mother was naturally frantic seeing all the blood on her only son, so she did what any mother frantic with worry for her child's welfare might do. She called a cab. Anyway, cut to 30 years later. My brother arrives at Kennedy Airport in New York on business, and he gets in a taxi to take him into the city. And as they drive along, the cab driver keeps looking into the rearview mirror at my brother. Finally, my brother asks, is something wrong? And the cab driver says, are you Todd Fisher? And after my brother verifies that he is, the cabbie pulls an old, crumpled, bloody strip of sheet out from the visor over the front passenger side of the car and brandishes it for my brother to see. I drove the cab that took you to the hospital that night with your mom back in the 70s. Of course he did. So the cabbie now has my brother sign the rag, brown and stiff with age, and then he drives back out of my brother's life, presumably forever. A nearby arranged all around her. My mother has moved into a house she bought next door from mine. There's this funny thing that she does now, which is to offer my brother and me things we can have after she's dead. If my eyes happen to rest on anything in her home, she rushes over and says, "Do you like this, dear? Because I can put a little sticker with your name on it to mark it now. Otherwise, I'll leave it for your brother." Of all her things, I guess I would want the blue dress with the blue beads and the blue fur. But the thing is, I'm pretty sure it disappeared. But I still want it sort of passionately. I'll have to ask her to see if she can find it, and if she does, get her to put a red dot on it. As a kid, I remember thinking there is no other mother that even comes close to my mom. Then I became a teenager and thought she was an asshole because, let's face it, it's a teenager's job to find her parent annoying and ridiculous. Just ask my daughter. Anyway, after I was finished thinking she was this trippy lunatic, I realized she was pretty fucking amazing. I mean, she's loyal, she's reliable, she's totally great, seriously. She's also really quick, and she can be really, really witty. She also still performs at the age of 76, and she never misses a show. Whether she's tired or her foot hurts, when she's out there on stage, she's radiant. This woman is the consummate performer. I've watched her for my whole life, and she's got this insanely strong life force. It pours through her veins and her muscles and her heart. She's remarkable. But here's the thing. She's also a little bit eccentric. She's always had a lot of unique ideas. For example, she thought it would be a good idea for me to have a child with her last husband, Richard, because it would have nice eyes. I should probably explain that, you know, my mother had gone through the change so she could no longer have children, and Richard didn't have any children of his own yet. And he had nice eyes. My womb was free, and we're related. Now, my mother didn't bring this up just once or twice like a normal mother would. She brought it up many, many times, and mostly while I was driving. And when I finally suggested to her that this might be an odd idea, she said, "Oh, darling, have you read The Inquirer lately? We live in a very strange world." Well, when The Inquirer becomes your standard for living, you're in a lot of trouble. When I told my grandmother about my mother's idea, she said, "Well, that's not right." The voice of reason. My grandmother, Maxine, is from El Paso, Texas. My mother's entire clan is from Texas, and my father's people are from South Philly and all around there. So basically, we're white trash. But because of the celebrity factor, I think of us as blue-blooded white trash. I bring my grandmother up because when my mother was about 7, my grandmother locked her in the closet, you know, for not finishing her dinner or homework. My grandmother was the one who told this story, by the way. Anyway, after my mother had been in the closet for about an hour, she asked my grandmother for a glass of water. And my grandmother naturally said, "Why?" And my mother said, "Because I've just spit on all your dresses, and now I've run out of spit, and I want to spit all over your shoes." These are the people I hail from. When I asked my grandmother later why she thought this form of discipline was appropriate, she said, "Well, we did not have Cosmopolitan magazine in those days, so we did not know that it was wrong." Don't you think my family has a really weird relationship with magazines? Anyway, my mother and I never did go forward with the plan for me to have Richard's baby, and I think that probably turned out to be a good thing. I mean, aside from the obvious, my sister, my daughter, my sister, my daughter, my mother ended up hating Richard, and she had a really good reason. He broke her pension plan and took all the money she'd made since Harry took the first batch. So she says to me at this point, "You know, dear, Eddie's starting to look like the good husband." Eddie, the Good Husband by Anton Chekhov. What can you say about my father? My father is unbelievably likable. I mean, you would love him. Now, he also smokes 4 joints a day. Not for medical reasons, so I call him Puff Daddy. But anyway, he is just adorable. There is a reason he was able to get all that high-quality pussy, except for Miss Louisiana, and anyone can make one mistake. So after he wrote his, well, he called it an autobiography. I thought of it more as a novel. After he wrote his novel, Been There, Done That, or, as I like to call it, Been There, Done Them, because it was really just about all the women he'd ever slept with and how the sex was and what their bodies were like. So it is a feel-good read. But after I read it, well, for starters, I wanted to get my DNA fumigated. But I read it partly out of loyalty and partly because the Inquirer had called me to ask how I felt about my father alluding to the fact that my mother was a lesbian in the book. Well, of course, it delighted me. And not that it matters, but my mother is not a lesbian, okay? She's just a really, really bad heterosexual. Both hands, one heart, two moods, and a head. A few years ago, my daughter and I visited my father in San Francisco, where he lives, because there's a really big Chinatown there. Anyway, the day before, he had just gotten these tiny little hearing aids. You know the ones that they fit right inside your ears? They're really, really expensive. Some people say $3,000, others say $5,000. Anyway, really expensive. So he'd gotten them the day before. So the night before, he didn't want to lose them or forget where they were. So he put them in his pillbox next to his bed so he'd remember where they were in the morning. Yep, that's right. He ate them. So whenever he couldn't hear my daughter or myself, we'd yell into his stomach or his ass. Now, he subsequently got those hearing aids again, and I had the opportunity to see them. They're the size of a lima bean, a rubber lima bean with an antenna. Now, look, I adore pills. I'm a huge fan, but these were like none I'd ever seen. Now, I don't know how you are in the morning. I'm not that sharp, but I think I would know if I were eating a rubber lima bean with an antenna. Twice! Well, if you have a life like mine, then these experiences gradually accumulate until you become known as a survivor. This is a term that I truly loathe. But the thing is, when you are a survivor, which, fine, I reluctantly agree that I am, and who over 40 isn't? When you are a survivor, in order to be a really good one, you have to keep getting in trouble to show off your gift. My mother says, "Well, dear, what are the choices? Not surviving?" But then This is from the woman who, when asked for dating advice, says, "For what age?" My mother, who incidentally lives next door to me, she calls me to this day and says, "Hello, dear, this is your mother, Debbie." You know, as opposed to my mother, Vladimir or Jean-Jacques. I have a very loud voice. I used to say my voice was designed to wrest people from dreams. My mother grew up in Texas on the border of Mexico, but she learned to speak properly with the assistance of Lillian Sidney, her vocal coach at MGM. Over time, she was able to gradually but completely lose her accent, unless she got really angry or frustrated with Todd and me. And then she's been known to say, "Carrie Francis, y'all get your butts in here." But my mom has what I can only describe as a movie star accent. It's very breathless and elegant, kind of mid-Atlantic. My brother and I frequently talk this way to each other now. "Hello, dear, this is your brother, Todd." A few years back, I interviewed my mother for this tragic cable talk show I was doing, and this was for the Mother's Day show. Anyway, we're chatting along pretty gaily for straight people, and then suddenly, somewhere in the middle of our little chat, my mother casually says, "You know, dear, it's like that time when I was a little girl and I was kidnapped." "What?" "Oh, darling, I told you about all of this, but you've just forgotten." Now, this was before my ECT, so there is no way I'd forget something like that. I doubt that even electroconvulsive therapy could banish a story as creepy as that one. So on she goes with this horrendous story, which I'm sure you're all dying to hear, like I was, just desperate to hear each and every horrifically vivid detail of a story increasingly tinged with darker hues of molestation. "Happy Mother's Day, everyone!" After my panic subsides somewhat, I hear her saying that when she was 8 or maybe younger, her 18-year-old neighbor and his friend scooped her up for a little joyride. I'll spare you the more grisly details, but the good news is, despite the fact that something extremely unsavory occurred, my mother wasn't, in fact, raped. Anyway, long, gross story short, the father of the boy who encouraged my mom to consider a part of his anatomy a lollipop called my grandmother and pleaded with her not to go to the police. "I guarantee you I'll make sure he never does this again." "How?" asked my grandmother. To which the boy's father somehow conveyed his intention to castrate his son. "I'll fix him so he can't." At this point, my grandmother generously reminded the boy's father that he hadn't actually raped her daughter, to which the father allegedly replied, "I just want to make sure he don't have the chance to do what he done again, and maybe next time it'd be worse. He's disgraced our family enough." Ah, the lovely family stories one has. When I was about 15, my mother had started dating a man named Bob Fallon, and my brother and I called him Bob Fallus because he came equipped with exotic creams and sex toys. You know, aphrodisiacs. Well, actually, anglodisiacs, because we're white. Anyway, thanks to Bob, that Christmas, my mother bought my grandmother and myself both vibrators. Now, as unusual as a gift like this sounds, you have to admit that they are the ideal stocking stuffers. I mean, you can fit the vibrator into the long top part of the stocking and still be able to get another cute little gift in the toe. Well, I have to admit, I enjoyed mine, but my grandmother refused to use hers. She was concerned that it would short-circuit her pacemaker. She said she'd gone this long without an orgasm, she might as well go the whole way. And that pacemaker, by the way, was later recalled. Now look, I know a lot of you might be thinking that many of the stories I'm telling you are way over the top, and I would totally have to agree. But you can't imagine what I'm leaving out. Anyway, I'd been singing in my mother's nightclub act since I was about 13, like most teenagers, and I continued to perform with her until I was 17. The last place that we played together was the London Palladium. And you know, I got pretty good reviews, so this choreographer contacts me and asked me if I want to do my own nightclub act. And I thought, well, maybe. You know, I could end up being financially independent. And Liza Minnelli, but, you know, you take the good with the bad. Anyway, my mother thought that this was a lousy idea. She thought it would be better if I went to drama college in England because it would bring respectability to the family. You know, like we were a bunch of hookers. And drama college in England's the only way to eradicate a taint like that. So now it's 1973 and I'm 17 and I'm enrolled at the Central School of Speech and Drama in London. And like I said, initially it wasn't my idea to go. But once I got there, it was some of the best times of my life. I mean, truly, it was the only unexamined part of my life where I was just a student among students, going to voice and movement class, and learning weird little tongue twisters, like, all I want is a proper cup of coffee, made in a proper cup of coffee pot. You can believe it or not, but I want a cup of coffee in a proper coffee pot. Tin coffee pots and iron coffee pots, they're no use to me. If I can't have a proper cup of coffee in a proper cup of coffee pot, I'll have a cup of tea. Now, if you enjoyed my performance as Princess Leia, and who could resist my stunning, layered, moving, not unlike Mary Poppins' performance, then it's thanks to tongue twisters like that. Consider, you'll never get that bucket of bolts past that blockade, proper cup of coffee pot. Or, why you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder? Proper cup or coffee bottle, have a cup of tea! And don't forget, I have that weird little English accent that came and went, like weather or bloat, all through the movie. And all my friends made fun of me because they said the title of the film sounded like a fight between my original parents. Star Wars! Accumulations of Incarnations. 43 years ago, George Lucas ruined my life. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. And now, 72 years later, people are still asking me if I knew Star Wars was going to be that big of a hit. Yes, of course I knew. We all knew. The only one who didn't know was George Lucas. We kept it from him because we wanted to see what his face looked like when it changed expression. And he fooled us even then. He got Industrial Light and Magic to change his facial expressions for him, and THX sound to make the noise of a face-changing expression. Not only was he virtually expressionless in those days, but he also hardly talked at all. His only two directions to the three of us in the first film were faster and more intense. Remember the trash compactor scene in the first Star Wars? When Harrison and Mark and Chewie have just rescued me from the prison cell on the Death Star, and we've just slid down the garbage chute and landed on a bunch of Death Star garbage and water? Well, under the water lived this serpent-like creature that in the script was called a Dianoga, though I don't think anyone ever referred to this thing by name in the actual film. So this creature, Dianoga, was meant to slither over to Mark, wrap itself around his neck, and strangle him as it pulled him under the surface of the water, leaving the rest of us up above to flip out. Anyway, during one of the takes, Mark was so intent on making his strangulation look realistic that he ended up bursting a blood vessel in his eye, which in turn left this bright red dot. So the following day, we shot our next scene, which happened to be the last scene in the movie. You know, the one where I give out all the medals? Mark had to grin like a motherfucker in that scene in order to conceal his red dot. Because ultimately, who's going to give a medal to someone with a big, stupid red dot in their eye? I don't care how much force is with him. George also made me take shooting lessons because in the first film, I would grimace horribly at the deafening sound of the blanks from the blasters and the squibs that the special effects team would place all over the set and on the stormtroopers. So George wanted to make me look like I'd been shooting blasters for my entire Alderaan existence. So he sent me to the same man who taught Robert De Niro to shoot weapons in Taxi Driver. Anyway, the shooting range was in this cellar in Midtown Manhattan, populated with policemen and all manner of firearm aficionados. I used to have this fantasy that in some distant Star Wars sequel, we'd finally stop all the shooting and screaming at each other, and we'd go to a shopping and beauty planet, where the stormtroopers would have to get facials, and Chewbacca would have to get pedicures and bikini and eyebrow waxes. I felt that at some point I should get, okay, fine, maybe not equal time, but just a few scenes where we did a lot of girly things. Imagine the shopping we might have done on Tatooine, or a little Death Star souvenir shop where you could get T-shirts that said, "My parents got the Force and jumped to light speed, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt." Or, "My boyfriend blew Jabba the Hutt, and all I got," etc., etc. You get the gist of my drift. But I have to admit, after a series of weapon instructions from a very pleasant ex-cop, I became quite proficient with an assortment of guns, including a double-barreled shotgun. Obviously, my family was so proud, because for fuck, or Darth's sake, I was always doing their stupid, endless fucking boy things. But back to the first film. Shortly after I arrived, George gave me this unbelievably idiotic hairstyle, and I'm brought before him like some sacrificial asshole, and he says to me in his little voice, "Well, what do you think of it?" And I say, because I'm terrified I'm going to be fired for being too fat, I say, "I love it!" Yeah, and the check's in the mail, and one size fits all, and I'll only put it in a little bit. Because, see, there was this horrible fat thing going on. When I got this great job to end all jobs, which, truly, I never thought I would get, because there were all these unbelievably pretty girls who were up for the same part. There was Amy Irving and Jodie Foster. This girl Terry Nunn almost got the part. Oh, and Christopher Walken almost got cast as Han Solo. Wouldn't that have been fantastic? Anyway, when I got this job, they told me I had to lose 10 pounds. Well, I weighed about 105 at the time, but to be fair, I carried about 50 of those pounds in my face. So you know what a good idea would be? Give me a hairstyle that further widens my already wide face. So you see, George Lucas is a sadist. But like any abused child wearing a metal bikini chained to a giant slug about to die, I keep coming back for more. Now why, you might ask? Well, I would answer, let's face it, George Lucas, the guy's a visionary, right? He's transported audiences the world over, and he's provided Mark and Harrison and myself with enough fan mail and even a small merry band of stalkers, keeping us entertained for the rest of our unnatural lives. not to mention identities that will follow us to our respective graves like a vague exotic smell. And speaking of graves, I tell my younger friends that one day they'll be at a bar playing pool, and they'll look up at the television set and there'll be a picture of Princess Leia with two dates underneath her face. And they'll say, "Oh, she said that would happen." And then they'll go back to playing pool. And don't forget, George Lucas was the man who made me into a little doll. And it barely even hurt. A little doll that one of my exes could stick pins into whenever he was annoyed with me. I found it in a drawer. He also made me into a shampoo bottle where people could twist off my head and pour liquid out of my neck. Paging Dr. Freud! And then there was a soap. A soap which read, "Lather up with Leia and you'll feel like a princess yourself." Boys. Oh, and the nice people at Burger King, they made me into a watch. And you know Mr. Potato Head? Well, they just came out with a Mr. Potato Head Star Wars series, so you might recognize me as Princess Tater, with my husband Dick and our daughter Rehabilitator. And I'm a tiny little stumpy Lego thing, which are delicious, by the way. And now there's even a stamp, which is totally cool. And not only because of the licking. But the main thing I've been made into that has really enhanced the quality of my life enormously, I'm a Pez dispenser. True story. Which not only has made my life unbelievably great, but it's enhanced the lives of everyone I run into. So if you can get someone to make you into a Pez dispenser, do it! And my daughter loves it because, you know, like I told you, she's a teenager and they love to humiliate the parent for sport. So all she has to do is flip my head back and pull a wafer out of my neck. But, you know, ultimately, I really don't mind. Even though among George's many possessions, he owns my likeness so that every time I look in the mirror, I have to send him a couple of bucks. That's partly why he's so rich. You know, because I'm vain. So I look in the mirror a lot and it adds up. You know, I saw yet another Leia figurine recently at one of those comic book conventions. Which, yes, I go to when I'm lonely. Anyway, this particular doll was on a turnstile. And when it got to a particular place on the turnstile, you could actually see up my dress to my anatomically correct, though shaved, galaxy snatch. Well, as you can imagine, because this probably happens to you all the time, I was a little taken aback by this. So I called George and I said, "You know what, man? Owning my likeness does not include owning my Lagoon of Mystery." Oh, and remember the white dress I wore all through the first movie? I mean, unless you didn't see Star Wars. Anyway, George comes up to me the first day of filming, and he takes one look at the dress, and he says, "You can't wear a bra underneath that dress." So I say, "Okay, I'll bite. Why?" And he says, "Because there's no underwear in space." I promise you this is true. And he says it with such conviction, too, you know, like he'd been to space and looked around and didn't see any bras or panties or briefs anywhere. Now, George came to my show when we did it in Berkeley, and he came backstage and he explained why you can't wear your brassiere in other galaxies. And I have a sense that you'll be going to outer space very soon, so here's why you cannot wear your brassiere, per George. So what happens is, you go to space and you become weightless. So far so good, right? But then your body expands, but your bra doesn't. So you get strangled by your bra. Now, I think this would make a fantastic obit. So I tell my younger friends that no matter how I go, it will be reported that I drown in moonlight, strangled by my bra. But, you know, George actually does have a point. Because, you know, when they send out those space probes and they beam back footage of what it looks like up there? All those films ever really show are sand and rocks. I mean, I've never seen a bra in any of that footage. So, instead of a bra, what do you think I wore for a bra intergalactically? Gaffer's tape! I used to think there should have been a contest at the end of the day for who in the crew would get to help remove the tape. Well, I was just thinking of others. Even then, I was just giving, giving, giving. But clearly, they've gone as far as they can go with this whole doll thing. I mean, what are they going to do next? Make a life-size Leia doll? You know, a kind of Stepford Leia? Which would render me obsolete. You'd read her book. So thank God they haven't done that. And thank God they haven't come up with a life-size Leia sex doll, because that would be truly humiliating. Thank God they haven't made an $800 sex doll that you can put in your cornfield to chase away crows. Oh, wait a second. They have! Okay, I admit, I knew about this. And I have to say it does turn out to be kind of a useful thing. Because if ever anyone tells me to go fuck myself, I can actually get the doll and give it a whirl. Well, this actually happened one night at my show. Someone from the far balcony screamed, "Go fuck yourself, Carrie!" So I had the crew load up the doll into my car, I took it back to my hotel, and I gotta tell you, I spent hours. Now, I need to point something out to you. This doll is cement. Now, I don't know how erotic that is for you, but it just doesn't do it for me anymore. Anyway, about 3:30 a.m., I tried to get the doll to do something with her hand and just fell off. So about 4 a.m., I think, oh my God, epiphany. The doll is heterosexual. But I really have no way of proving this theory because I no longer have a penis. It's been revoked until the financial crisis is over. From what I can see of the people like me, we get better, but we never get well. Paul Simon wrote that. Years ago, there were tribes that roamed the earth, and every tribe had a magic person. Well, now, as you know, all the tribes have been dispersed, but every so often you meet a magic person, and every so often you meet someone from your tribe. Which is how I felt when I met Paul Simon. Paul and I had the secret handshake of shared sensibility, you know? We understood each other perfectly. Obviously, we didn't always agree, but we understood the terms of our disagreements. My mother used to say, "You know, dear, Paul can be very charming when he wants to be." And my father just wanted Paul to write an album for him. Anyway, Paul and I dated for 6 years, we were married for 2, divorced for 1, and then we had good memories of each other. So what do you think we did? No, we didn't remarry, we dated again, which is exactly what you want to do after you've been married and divorced. Samuel Johnson once said that remarrying, and he's not talking about marrying the same person here, just remarrying, is the triumph of hope over experience. So for me, remarrying the same person is the triumph of nostalgia over judgment. So Paul and I were together for over 12 years, off and on, and we traveled to a bunch of places, all over the world, really. The last place we went together was the Amazon, which I highly recommend, by the way, if you like mosquitoes. Anyway, when we got back, Paul wrote an album based on South American music called Rhythm of the Saints. And on this album is the last song he ever wrote about me. And it's called She Moves On. An ironic title. Now, by the way, if you can get Paul Simon to write a song about you, do it! Because he is so brilliant at it. Anyway, one of the lyrics in the song goes like this. She's like a top, she cannot stop. So, yeah, he knew me. But the lyric I really wanted to tell you about was this. And I'm afraid that I'll be taken, abandoned, and forsaken in her cold coffee eyes. Yep, I'm a bitch. Now, Paul didn't just write unpleasant songs about me. You know that song, Graceland? She's come back to tell me she's gone, as if I didn't know that, as if I didn't know my own bed, as if I didn't notice the way she brushed her hair from her forehead. See? Recognize me now? He wrote other nice things about our time together, but you know how with exes you tend to remember more of the negative things than the positive ones? No? I guess it's only me then. He wrote another song called Allergies, and the lyric from that was, "My heart is allergic to the woman I love, and it's changing the shape of my face." Do you think that's flattering? I don't think it really is. But Paul wrote another album, a beautiful album. Well, they're all beautiful, but this particular one was called Hearts and Bones. And the title song, Hearts and Bones, was about us, and it went like this. One and one half wandering Jews return to their natural coast to resume old acquaintances, step out occasionally, and speculate who had been damaged the most. But that couldn't be it because I didn't get permission to reprint those lyrics, so that would be really bad, wouldn't it? Oh, it isn't really bad because I didn't take any alimony from Paul. So try to think of it this way. You're listening to my alimony. And lovely alimony it is. One and one half wandering Jews speculate who had been damaged the most. Guess who won that contest? Poor Paul. He had to put up with a lot with me. I think ultimately I fell under the heading good anecdote, bad reality. I was really good for material, but when it came to day-to-day living, I was a little more than he could take. We once had a fight on our honeymoon where I said, "Not only do I not like you, I don't like you personally." We tried to keep the argument going after that, but we were laughing too hard. Another time he said to me, "You're the only girl I know that compliments herself." And I said, "I think it's sweet that I do it, though." And the last one was, he said, "I'm right, and you know I'm right." And I said, "Maybe, but I'm younger, and I'm willing to go all night." So, I married Paul at 26, we divorced when I was 28, and at 29, I went into rehab. Not because I needed it, but because I was doing research for my novel, Postcards from the Edge, and I needed to meet some real drug addicts and alcoholics to give the book some veracity. Sadness squared. Okay, have it your way. I'm a drug addict. You know how they say religion is the opiate of the masses? Well, I took masses of opiates religiously. But you cannot chalk it up to my goofy childhood. You can try, but you're going to have a hard time. Because my brother, Todd, coincidentally, had the same exact childhood and, freakishly, the same parents. But Todd has never had a substance abuse problem. So it's not what you're given, it's how you take it. Now, my brother is born-again Christian. But what I like to say about that is, what father could Todd find who was more famous than Eddie Fisher, but that he could talk to every day? Because you can. Oh, Jesus. Now, I'd always written, ever since I was about 14, you know, poems, journals, stuff like that. But when I was 28, I was interviewed for Esquire magazine. And the interview turned out funny, I guess. I mean, it had one-liners in it like, instant gratification takes too long. Anyway, a publishing house saw the interview and they liked it, so they wrote me a letter asking me if I wanted to write a book. And that letter was forwarded to me in the rehab. And I was glad to get mail from anybody. But I did. I did want to write a book, and I knew what the first line would be. Maybe I shouldn't have given the guy who pumped my stomach my phone number. But he'll never call me anyway. No one will ever call me again. And this was actually based on a true thing. See, the doctor that pumped my stomach sent me flowers with a note that read, I can tell that you're a very warm and sensitive person. All that from the contents of my stomach. I was tempted to marry him so I could tell people how we met. Anyway, I wrote Postcards from the Edge in Los Angeles when I was 28. Then I got back together with Paul again, so I wrote the screenplay for Postcards in New York. And then they start filming the movie in Los Angeles with Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine. Well, I want to be on that set. So I start flying out to L.A. from New York a lot. And this was really bad for my relationship with Paul. And pretty soon, we both knew it was over. He might have known a little sooner than I did. Mike Nichols used to say about us that we were two flowers, no gardener. No one was minding the relationship. One time when I was flying back to L.A., one of the last times, Paul and I had been fighting all morning, so he drove me to the airport to get rid of me faster, and I was about to get on the plane, and I turned to him and said, "You'll feel bad if I crash." And he shrugged and said, "Maybe not." Oh, and around that time, I got a call from my business office that Bob Dylan wanted my phone number. And I said, "Fuck you. You get that stalker away from me. I don't want any more 60s icons fucking up my life." That's what I said in my head. Out loud, I said, "Absolutely, I'll be waiting by the phone." Dylan wasn't calling to ask me on a date. He was calling because this cologne company had contacted him to see if he would endorse a cologne called Just Like a Woman. Bob didn't like that name, but he liked the idea of endorsing a cologne, and he wanted to know if I had any good cologne idea names. Do I look like someone who would be wandering around with a bunch of cologne names rattling around in my head? Well, tragically, I did. I did have quite a few ideas for cologne names, and so I told him to Bob. There was ambivalence for that scent of confusion, arbitrary for the man who doesn't give a shit how he smells, and empathy, feel like them, smell like this. Well, Bob actually liked those, and then he said he thought he might like to open a beauty salon. And I said, "What, like Tangled Up and Blown?" Anyway, a couple of weeks later, I saw George Harrison at this dinner party, as one does. So I tell him about the Bob call, and he says, "Don't worry, because, you know, whenever Bob is on the road for a long time, he starts thinking about finding a regular job. You know, a job that will take him off the road." It turns out that Bob had phoned George the week before to see if he wanted to open the Traveling Wilbury Hotel. So a short time after this, I invite Bob to a party at my house, and he arrives with his girlfriend, who was my neighbor at the time, and he's wearing a parka with sunglasses. And I say, "Thank God you wore that, Bob, because sometimes late at night here, the sun gets really, really bright, and then it snows." Later at the party, I introduce Bob to Meryl Streep, and he takes her hand and he says, "Oh, yeah, I know you. You were great in... And while he's holding her hand, she now has to go through what turned out to be basically all her movies, which takes a while because his favorite turned out to be Ironweed. My mother doesn't always come to my parties. She doesn't have to, really, because she's right next door and can listen to them from across the driveway. But she's always been there for me. I mean, obviously she was upset about my drug addiction, what mother wouldn't be. But on some level, she wasn't as upset as she was with my failure to do a nightclub act. Well, that and dating an agent. She grounded me for weeks when she found out about that. But when he ended up fathering her extraordinary granddaughter, Billy, all was forgiven. One of my dozens of psychiatrists once told me that it's important to be able to distinguish the difference between a problem and an inconvenience. The Oxford English Dictionary defines a problem as a thing thrown or put forward, hence a question propounded for solution. A set task, a difficult or puzzling question, proposed for solution. The first use of the word was in 1382. So I suppose prior to that, there was either no way to put a name to one's difficulties, or everyone lived in a world of different levels of inconvenience. Then, after 1382, problemizing could be the order of the day. An inconvenience, on the other hand, is defined as being troublesome. This was in the mid-1600s, so I imagine there were 300 years of problems between 1382 and 1656. But no matter what the dictionary says, in my opinion, a problem derails your life, and an inconvenience is not being able to get a nice seat on the underailed train. Now, given that, I've had 3.5 problems. Dead guy in my bed, substance abuse, and manic depression. My final little problemette stems from the difficulty I seem to have in romantic relationships. Specifically, I'm referring to the last categorically serious relationship I had. I was left by a man for a man. Billy's father left me for a man named Scott when she was 1 year old, making Scott the man who got the man that got away. Anyway, armed with my understanding between a problem and an inconvenience, I realize I've been blessed with very few problems in my life. I mean, let's face it, to complain about my childhood or even a sizable portion of my life would be as unattractive as it would be inaccurate. I had a very privileged life growing up, a beautiful, loving, eccentric mother, an even-tempered, and consequently odd to me, bright, kind, religious brother, a charming, handsome, womanizing, yet virtually absent father, lovely grandparents, and a series of dogs and a bird. I mean, I had it all. Which is to say, I had a hearty mix of good and not so hot, like many people. Right after I got sober, the first time, an interviewer asked me if I was happy, and I said, among other things. Happy is one of the many things I'm likely to be over the course of a day, and certainly over the course of a lifetime. But I think if you have the expectation that you're going to be happy throughout your life, more to the point, if you have a need to be comfortable all the time, well, among other things, you have the makings of a classic drug addict or alcoholic, which obviously is what I became. But actually, through therapy and exposure to the wisdom found in 12-step programs and beyond, I've gotten an enormous portion of my compulsion for comfort under control. One night, I had to go to a meeting, this 3-hour meeting I've gone to every week for the last 10 years. By the way, no, I haven't stayed sober for that long, but my failure to achieve long-term sobriety is just that, my failure, not the failure of the program. I first started going to meetings when I was 28, but it was at this particular 3-hour meeting that I heard someone say that I didn't have to like meetings, I just had to go to them. Well, this was a revelation to me. I thought I had to like everything I did. And for me, to like everything I did meant, well, among other things, that I needed to take a boatload of dope. Which I did for many, many years. But if what this person told me were true, then I didn't have to actually be comfortable all the time. If I could, in fact, learn to experience a quota of discomfort, it would be awesome news. And if I could consistently go to that 3-hour meeting, I could also exercise and I could write. In short, I could actually be responsible. But I didn't learn this until after 3 of my 3.5 problems had occurred. The overdose, the bipolar diagnosis, and the man that got the man that got away. It seemed to me like a lot of my trouble showed up in sex, it being the alleged road to love and all. In almost, well, I won't say every other situation, but in a lot of situations, you can hardly tell there's anything really wrong with me. I just have basically too much personality for one person and not quite enough for two. But in the area of romance, boom, you know right away. When I was little, about 7, I guess, I remember getting in the car with my mother when she picked me up from school and telling her I had seen the word fuck written on the handball court at the playground, and I wanted to know what it meant. And she said, "I'll have to tell you later, dear, when I can draw you diagrams." Well, needless to say, later never came, and neither did, I'm sorry to report, those promised diagrams. Which is a shame, really, because I think they would have come in pretty handy from time to time. Armed with my mother's diagrams, I might have moved through the world of dating in smooth, easy motions. Like a queen, with that straight-back certainty that comes with being entitled, cared for, and wearing crowns. But without those diagrams, I shuffle around like some street person, clumsy and stooped, with the carriage of someone who picks through the trash, shopping for dinner. But let's face it, the world of sex is weird no matter how you look at it. I mean, 14 hours after you've had your face smashed into someone's genitals, you're walking down the street with them as though that were all just fine. Thank you. How are you? The first crush I ever had was on a boy called Willie Breton. For some reason, my friends and I used to say his name without using our tongues, which, for whatever reason, was highly enjoyable. I can't recommend it as an activity highly enough. Feel free to try it when you're really bored. Anyway, as it happens, Willie is now an Orthodox rabbi living in Israel with his wife and 10 children. How often have I wistfully thought to myself, if I played my carnal cards right, that could have been me. Actually, never. Many years later, when I was in Jerusalem on my honeymoon with Paul, we met up with Willie, now Rabbi Willie, and his wife for lunch. Willie and Paul fought ceaselessly, largely about the deportation of the Arabs from the West Bank. Rabbi Willie for, Rabbi Paul against. I never realized how fun it could be to get a current partner and a past partner together and then pit them against each other. I mean, if you can't really find a good book to read. Ultimately, Paul and I went our separate ways. He went on to marry someone much younger than himself, 25 years, and from the South, Edie Brickell, and so, not to be outdone, I found myself a mate younger than myself, 4 years, and also from the South, Brian Lord. The only difference between our choices, well, his was a girl, mine was a boy, my choice forgot to tell me that he was gay. Well, he forgot to tell me and I forgot to notice. Hey, you know, it could happen. You know when you're first in love and you're grinning at each other like goofballs all the time and making out
Everything just looks better when you're infatuated, doesn't it? Like it's lit from within. And you're telling each other everything, like, I'm a Libra, I like fireflies on a summer night, I like long moonlit walks on the beach on acid. Oh, did I forget to tell you I was gay? I should have had a V8. Actually, he told me later that I had turned him gay by taking codeine again. And I said, you know, I never read that warning on the label. I thought it said heavy machinery, not homosexuality. Turns out I could have been driving those tractors all along. Turning people gay is kind of a superpower of mine. It's not called upon a lot, but when it is, I pick up my little pink phone, I put on my rainbow-colored cape, and I'm there like a shot. You know, I was probably turning people gay for a long, long, long time, you know, without knowing it, because I took a lot of codeine, and I traveled. So there are probably pockets of homosexual communities all over the world started by me. You may have seen some of my handiwork. My doctor told me that codeine stays in your liver for 7 years. I mean, unless you have a good lawyer. Well, I don't. I do not have a good lawyer, so what I'm trying to say is there's probably some codeine still left in my liver. So, if you find yourself on your knees in front of someone of the same sex, nude, and that's not where you usually hang out, happy Hanukkah from all of us at Wishful Drinking. Brisk as a bullet shot through the center of everything. I was probably rebounding from Paul when I met Brian a week later, but Brian is really, really attractive. Well, when I met him, he had hair. I do that too. I make them bald, I turn them gay, my work is done. But Brian took really, really good care of me, and this was really the first time that a man had ever done that. You know, my father left when I was 2. Oh, poor sad Carrie. And Paul and I were the 2 flower things, so this was the first time a man had ever taken care of me. I mean, he used to give me baths like I was a Labrador. Brian took such good care of me, I thought, this guy will make a good father. And I was right. He made a great father. And he still does. So, fearing now that finally everything would be all right, 9 months later, our daughter was dragged from my body as though it were a burning building. And once this well-fed round creature was rescued from the rubble of me, I sent out a birth announcement, which read, someone's summered in my stomach, someone's fallen through my legs. To make an infant omelet, simply scramble sperm and eggs. So Brian and I named our adorable little omelet Billy, Billy Catherine Lord. So, a year later, when Brian left me for Scott, well, naturally, I was devastated. I love Brian, and I really like those baths. But my mother was fantastic to me during this time. I mean, my mother, she's like a mother to me, you know? And she said this great thing. She said, you know, dear, we've had all sorts of men in our family. We've had horse thieves and alcoholics and one-man bands, but this is our first homosexual. Anyway, having nothing to do with Brian, about a year after that, I was invited to go to a mental hospital. And you know, you don't want to be rude, so you go. Okay, I know what you must be thinking, but this is a very exclusive invitation. I mean, hello, have you ever been invited to a mental hospital? So you see, it's very exclusive. It's sort of like an invitation to the White House, only you meet a better class of people in the mental hospital. My diagnosis was manic depression. I think today they call it bipolar. So you might say I swing both ways. But unless you said it really, really loud, I probably wouldn't hear you.
Oh, before I forget, my mother wants you all to know that this comes from my father's side of the family. She is as normal as the day is long. But imagine this, though. Imagine having a mood system that functions essentially like weather, you know, so independently of whatever's going on in your life. So the facts of your life stay the same, just the emotional fiction that you're responding to differs. It's like I'm not properly insulated. So all the bad and the good ways that you and most of the people in the adjacent neighborhoods and around the world feel, that pours directly into my system unchecked. It is so fun. I call it getting on my grid, or ESP, egregious sensory protection. But ultimately, I feel I'm very sane about how crazy I am. But periodically, I do explode. Now, the good news about this is that over time, the explosions have gotten smaller and the recovery time is faster. But what is guaranteed is that I will explode. So what I do, because I'm a good hostess, except for the Greg thing, I provide my guests with bibs so that they don't get my crazy juice all over their nice clothes. You know how most illnesses have symptoms you can recognize, right? Like fever, upset stomach, chills, whatever. Well, with manic depression, it's sexual promiscuity, excessive spending, and substance abuse. That just sounds like a terrific weekend in Vegas to me. Oh, this will impress you. I am actually in the abnormal psychology textbook. Obviously, my family's so proud. Keep in mind now, I'm a Pez dispenser, and I'm in the abnormal psychology textbook. Who says you can't have it all? But when I was told about the textbook, I was told I was in there with a photo. And I said, huh? What photo? I mean, it's not like anyone ever called me and said, you know, have you got a little snapshot of yourself looking depressed or manic? You know, like from my show. So for years I wondered, what picture? Well, I have excellent news. Recently I found the picture, and it's a picture of me as Princess Leia. See, so I'm not crazy. That bitch is. Anyone that would wear a hairstyle like that has to be nuts, right? Having received word at an early age that the rest of my life was going to be challenging, at least at very odd intervals, I started seeing a shrink when I was 15. The first was recommended to me by my friend Joan Hackett, and he was a psychologist and not a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists are medical doctors as well as the rest of the psycho stuff. So they're better trained to diagnose mental illness and, oh, so much more importantly, prescribe medication for it. In any case, so to speak, this doctor failed to diagnose my manic depression. Though one day, after I'd been seeing him for many years, he suddenly asked if I'd been hyperactive as a child. Yeah, right. And I just somehow forgot to mention a little thing like that. I mean, it wasn't as if I had an endless supply of life struggles to discuss with him at that point. Although, surely adolescence is a struggle in and of itself, but not so much so that I'd somehow forgotten to mention my hyperactivity. But I think that my first doctor saw something in me that was amiss, but as to what that something was, for the moment, would remain a mystery. My second doc knew exactly what was up with me. Though generally it's useless to diagnose someone as bipolar who's engaged in ingesting large quantities of drugs or alcohol, which I was, because drug addiction and alcoholism, done properly, of course, classically mimics the symptoms of manic depression. So when I was 24 years old, Dr. Barry Stone told me that it was his utterly professional opinion that I was hypomanic, also known as bipolar 1, which is the lesser version of manic depression. Excessively moody as opposed to bipolar 2, excruciatingly moody,
which includes the occasional hallucination and lockup ward visits. As it turns out, I was ultimately determined to be the latter, excruciatingly moody. But from where old Doc Stone sat, at this point, I was simply excessively moody. Hey, maybe the whole show hadn't kicked in yet. Or, better still, maybe the drugs were suppressing my symptoms to a certain extent. I mean, that's at least in part why I ingested chemical waste. It was a kind of desire to abbreviate myself, to present the cliff notes of the emotional me as opposed to the 12-volume read. I used to refer to my drug use as putting the monster in the box. I wanted to be less, so I took more. Simple as that. Anyway, I eventually decided that the reason that Dr. Stone had told me that I was hypomanic was that he wanted to put me on medication instead of actually treating me. So I did the only rational thing I could do in the face of such an insult. I stopped talking to Stone, flew back to New York, and married Paul Simon a week later. Jump cut to 2 years after that, and you'll find me overdosing. Not that that was my intention by any means. That was simply the amount of drugs that had become necessary for me to take to get where I wanted to go. My destination being simply anywhere but here. But somehow, en route to that numb place, I'd overshot my mark and almost arrived at nowhere but dead. Well, after that happened, I was quite naturally upset and terrified. I had in no way intended to risk my life. I just wanted to turn the sound down and smooth all of my sharp corners, block out the dreadfully noisy din of not being good enough, which, on occasion, I was actually able to do. But how had I almost managed to end up at the destination of dead when that was never the direction I originally set off in? It's as if I tripped and almost fell into my own grave. My only intent was to feel better, which is to say not to feel at all. So, based on the fact that my best thinking got me in an emergency room with a tube down my throat, I had no trouble at all accepting the fact that I was an alcoholic. Not that I drank much, you might say I took pills alcoholically. Anyway, I didn't have any difficulty accepting the notion that my life had become unmanageable. I mean, let's face it, my most creative achievement at that time was having unnecessary gum surgery just for the morphine. I don't think you can actually use the word just and morphine anywhere near each other. So I threw myself into 12-step group recovery, believing now that alcoholism was the headline and the overriding thing wrong with me, which was, of course, in large part true and remains true to this day. Because I have to admit, well, I don't have to, but periodically I have had drug slips. All in, I've had 4 slips since I started going to 12-step support groups at the age of 28. Making that 4 slips in 23 years, which is not great. I mean, I'm not proud that I wasn't able to remain sober that entire time, especially in terms of my daughter, who's had to suffer the most from these largely inexcusable forays back down the dark path that is drug use. The most painful thing about returning to this grim planet is seeing the look of disappointment and hurt that these forays invariably put in the eyes of your loved ones. But ultimately, you could say that I don't have a problem with drugs so much as I have a problem with sobriety. And it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous that failed me. It's that I have, on occasion, failed them by not working what they call a good program. But I keep going back. I'm as addicted to all things AA has to offer as I am to the things that made me need those groups in the first place. But when I first got to 12-step land after my stomach-pumping incident, I thought, okay, fine then. This is what's the matter with me. I'm not going to shrinks anymore. My best shrinking and thinking got me into emergency rooms all over Southern California. So I planned to be an all-meeting, all-the-time gal. Psychiatrists were a thing of the past. Why, they hadn't even told me I was an alcoholic. So screw them, especially the doctor who tried to convince me that I was hypomanic. Fat lot he knew. Well, as it turned out, what he knew was an extremely fat lot after all. Because over the next year of getting and staying clean and sober, all the people I'd come into the program with were calming down and leveling out, while I seemed to be doing just the opposite. Quick to excite, to agitate, to engage, to anger, I was heading straight up into the rafters of my overly good or bad time. In short, okay, fine, yes, I know it's far too late for that, I was manic. The monster was out of the box, the cat was out of the bag, and it appeared that after a year of erratic sobriety, that I was en route back to the shrinks and psychopharmacologists I had imagined myself not needing anymore. Without the substances I had used to distort and mask my symptoms, it was now all too clear that I was a bona fide wild-ride manic depressive. And this initially dismaying discovery led me to my third and best shrink, Beatrice Foster, who turned out to be the psychiatrist who finally got me to address my manic depression. And I ultimately not only addressed it, I named my two moods Roy and Pam. Roy is rollicking Roy, the wild ride of a mood, and Pam is sediment Pam, who stands on the shore and sobs. Pam stands for piss and moan. One mood is the meal, the next mood, the check. There are a couple reasons why I take comfort in being able to put all this in my own vernacular and present it to you. For one thing, because then I'm not completely alone with it. And for another, it gives me a sense of being in control of the craziness. Now, this is a delusion. But it's my delusion, and I'm sticking with it. It's sort of like I have problems, but problems don't have me. Statistics say that a range of mental disorders affect more than 1 in 4 Americans in any given year. That means millions and millions of people are totally batshit. But having perused the various tests available that they use to determine whether you're manic depressive, OCD, schizoaffective, schizophrenic, or whatever, I'm surprised the number's that low. So I've gone through a bunch of available tests, and I've taken questions from each of them and assembled my own psychological evaluation screen, which I thought I'd share with all of you. So here are some of the things they ask to determine if you're mentally disordered. If you say yes to any number of these questions, you too could be insane. 1. In the last week, have you been feeling irritable? 2. In the last week, have you gained a little weight? 3. In the last week, have you not always felt like talking to people? 4. Do you no longer get as much pleasure out of doing certain things as you used to? 5. In the last week, have you felt fatigued? 6. Do you think about sex a lot? If you don't say yes to any of these questions, either you're a big liar, or you don't speak English, or you're illiterate, in which case I have the distinct impression I may have lost you quite a few chapters ago. An altered, faltering self. Now, come back with me to when I was first told that I was an alcoholic, which greatly relieved me, by the way, because I knew something was the matter with me. So I thought, well, great, that's what it is. That's what I've been struggling with and enjoying all this time. Fantastic. But what they further do to, I think, you know, soften the blow of this arguably awkward new way of looking at yourself, they enumerate a number of other famous and accomplished folks who have also struggled with and enjoyed alcoholism. So, for example, there was Scott Fitzgerald, Mel Gibson, Dylan Thomas, Ireland, Rush Limbaugh, Lindsay Lohan, Russia, and George W. Bush. I think their point is, don't feel bad. You're joining an illustrious group. Great people have been alcoholics.
Oh, B1, it's fun. Now, I don't think they're implying that, you know, we could all be great, but these people weren't exactly losers, except probably to some members of their family and all their constituents. So relax and join the great drunks who staggered the earth before you. So, when I was told I was a manic depressive, there was a whole other list waiting for me. There was Abraham Lincoln, who wrote the Gettysburg Address in 4 hours. Now, that's pretty manic. Winston Churchill, who called his depressed mood the black dog. Korea. Christy McNichol and Sir Isaac Newton, who I think would have made an adorable couple. Mark Twain, St. Francis, St. Teresa, Jonathan Winters, poor Britney Spears, and George W. Bush. Well, naturally, after this list, I felt invigorated. But then, that is part of my diagnosis. So, to celebrate my newfound ascent into the lofty heights of this noble group, I thought I would inaugurate a bipolar pride day. You know, with floats and parades and stuff. On the floats, we would get the depressives. They wouldn't even have to leave their beds. We'd just roll their beds out of their houses, and they could continue staring miserably into space. Then, for the manics, we'd have the manic marching band, with the manics laughing and talking and shopping and fucking and making bad judgment calls. Of course, all this is still in the early planning stages, and knowing manics, it probably always will be. But the point is, we have a plan, and that's what counts. Because when you're manic, every urge is like an edict from the Vatican. No plan is a bad one, because if you're there and you're doing it, can't be bad. It's like a bank error in your favor. Mania is, in effect, liquid confidence. When the tide comes in, it's all good. But when the tide goes out, the mood that cannot and should not be named comes over you and into you. Because to name it would be an act of summoning. Losing your mind is frightening. Especially if you have a lot to lose, but once it's lost, it's fine. Absolutely no big deal. You could have a light shining out of your head. It's sort of like glowing in your own dark. Part of my story, because God forbid you miss a minute of it, I stayed awake for 6 days. Now, this happened because two of my medications were interacting badly, so the doctors put me on what they called a medication vacation. There is no Club Med, and you can't send any cute little postcards. Now, anyone who has stayed awake for 6 days knows that there's every chance that they'll wind up psychotic. Anyway, I did. And part of how that manifested itself was that I thought everything on television was about me. Now, if anything like this should happen to you, I have some excellent advice. Don't watch CNN. Please, watch one of those pet training shows or cooking show. Even some of the Discovery shows are fine. But I watched CNN, and at the time, Versace had just been killed by that man Cunanan, and the police were frantically scouring the eastern seaboard for Cunanan. So I was Cunanan, Versace, and the police. Now this is exhausting programming. But by the time I got to be Versace, he was dead. And also, by then, I was in the real hospital part of Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, and I could literally hear the nurses outside my door saying, "Don't listen to her, she's crazy." My brother eventually arrived, and he had to call the mental hospital to see about getting me in because there was, as my friend Dave says, no room at the bin. You had to be seriously nuts to qualify for residence in the lockdown ward. So, finally, the head doctor of the facility came over.
This guy looked like this kind of weird John Steinbeck character, with his abnormally high pants and his strangely neat hair and his trimmed just-so beard. Anyway, he walks in, and I say, "Finally, here's someone who can tell us what it's like to get his cock sucked." Because, as you might have noticed, I had begun swearing a lot, and apparently I couldn't stop. Something in me had become unleashed, and taming it was not imminent. Anyway, this was my audition for the locked ward, and as you probably guessed by now, I passed! I made it into the mental hospital! Hooray! When you qualify for the mental hospital, you have to sign yourself in, you know, like commitment papers, I guess. But I was so far gone, I didn't know what I was signing or doing, and so when they finally put the papers in front of me, I took the pen and signed with my left hand, "Shame." That's how I signed in for the mental hospital. How sad is that? Oh, and my form of mental illness is also a tiny, tiny bit infectious, by the way. I may have gotten it from Amy Winehouse's toilet seat. So by the end of this book, you could be gay and insane, unless you began that way. Anyway, ever since my fateful announcement on Diane Sawyer that I was mentally ill, like anyone really needed to know that. Don't you hate it when celebrities just blah, 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 talk about themselves? I mean, who asked? I just find it all so wearying. Anyway, where was I? So, having waited my entire life to get an award for something, you know, anything. Fine, okay, not acting, but what about a tiny little award for writing? No. I now get awards all the time for being mentally ill. I'm apparently very good at it, and I am honored for it regularly. Probably one of the reasons I'm such a shoo-in is there's no swimsuit portion of the competition. Well, it's better than being bad at being mentally ill, right? I mean, how tragic would it be to be runner-up for Bipolar Woman of the Year? The first time I did drugs was when I was 13. Before we lost all our money, my family had a vacation house in Palm Springs, about 2 hours outside of Beverly Hills, where I ostensibly grew up. So, periodically, my mother used to rent that house in Palm Springs to these people who, after one of their stays, left behind a bag of marijuana. Who knows? Maybe they left it intentionally, you know, a kind of chemical sacrifice on the altar of appreciation for their time there. Anyway, after my mother found the pot, she came to me and said, "Dear, I thought instead of your going outside and smoking pot where you might get caught, and get in trouble, I thought you and I might experiment with it together." Well, frankly, at the time, and let's face it even now, I couldn't imagine anything weirder. But what actually came to pass was that after presenting this bizarre, albeit marginally appealing proposal, my mother got swept back up into the whirlwind of her life and promptly forgot about it. But being the crafty, eager for the altered state person I was destined to become, I absolutely did not. So once it became obvious that our proposed experiment had slipped my mother's mind, I snuck into the lab of her sachet underwear drawer and stole the pot, subsequently experimenting my brains out in my backyard treehouse with my friend May, who coincidentally also ended up in AA. And you've got to figure that I enjoyed it, because I ended up experimenting with marijuana for the next 6 years, until it suddenly, and I think rather rudely, turned on me. Where at the onset it was all giggles and munchies and floating in a friendly haze, it suddenly became creepy and dark and scary. What was a junkie to do? Well, the answer was quite obvious. I needed to find a new replacement drug. This was when I was about 19, while I was filming Star Wars. It ultimately turned out to be Harrison's pot that did me in. So after carefully casting about for a substitute substance, I finally settled into my new drug digs. Hallucinogens and opiates. Mind expanders and painkillers. Though over time and protracted use, their meanings got jumbled until they became mind relievers and pain expanders, a place where everything hurt and nothing made sense. Anyway, at a certain point in my early 20s, my mother started to become worried about my obviously ever-increasing drug ingestion. So she ended up doing what any concerned parent would do. She called Cary Grant. In case you haven't heard, one of the many things Mr. Grant was known for at the time was the fact that at some point in the 60s, he famously did a course of LSD while under a doctor's supervision. It's always been difficult for me to imagine this. Do they actually drop the acid in the doctor's office? Does the doctor do it too? I always thought there was a kind of strange dignity and an even stranger credibility given to acid done under the cool shade of medical supervision. Sometimes, when I heard the phrase experimenting with drugs, I imagined someone in a white coat excitedly emerging from a lab carrying a smoking beaker and shouting, "I found it! I found it!" But when I heard that Cary Grant had experimented with acid under the supervision of his doctor, well, in a way, it was as if he was dedicating his hallucinogenic jaunt to modern science. I imagine him doing it a little reluctantly and with a quiet dignity. After, of course, washing his hands and putting on one of those little backless hospital garbs 10 minutes before the medicinal acid kicked in. Anyway, my concerned and caring mother called Cary Grant and told him that her daughter had a problem with acid. You know, like I was mainlining the stuff. You have to admit, though, on a certain level, it was an incredibly darling thing for her to do, especially when you consider the fact that I loved Cary Grant. I still do, only now at more of a distance. He's probably the only famous person I was ever really in awe of. Having two celebrity parents and a few celebrity boyfriends, it was extremely rare for me to get starstruck. Not that I was blasé about famous people, I just wasn't bowled over and tongue-tied and staring, as if I'd just undergone more electric shock therapy or stuck my finger in a socket. But Cary Grant, well, he just killed me. I mean, I was completely blown away by him. He had it all. An easygoing class, quiet confidence, wit, all in this beyond handsome package. So when the phone rang and a familiar voice informed me that he was Cary Grant, even a Cary Grant that was going to maybe give me a just-say-no drug lecture, well, initially I was, in fact, totally tongue-tied. Normally, I wouldn't have believed that the person on the other end really was Cary Grant. But when he told me my mother had asked him to call, well, that sounded eerily like some bizarre thing my mother would do. In a way, there was actually a precedent for this Cary Grant intervention call. Some years prior, I was in London en route to my mother's wedding. I don't like to miss any of my parents' weddings. She called me at the hotel where I was staying, and when I didn't answer the phone, she became understandably concerned. So she let the phone ring and ring and ring until finally she panicked. She knew I was in the room, so in her mind, probably the only reason I wasn't answering the phone was that I had overdosed. So she did what any normal, concerned mother might do when troubled about her daughter's well-being. She called Ava Gardner. And she asks Ava to come to my hotel and get the concierge to let her in my room to make sure I'm not dead. Anyway, the reason this relates to Cary Grant, if it isn't obvious, is that the Ava Gardner Rescue Squad, good title for a rock band, is the reason that I would even begin to believe that someone telling me that they were Cary Grant might actually, in fact, be Cary Grant. So, initially, when I got on the phone with Mr. Grant, I was incredibly nervous seeing as how I was on the phone with no less than my fucking hero. But once we began to discuss my acid addiction, after a freakishly short time, I found myself chatting gaily with what might as well have been a Cary Grant impersonator. Because let's face it, there was no actual visual confirmation that this was, in fact, Cary Grant. So I think I finally convinced him that, despite my mother's insistence, I didn't have an acid problem, which, for the most part, was true. What I did have was an opiate problem, but frankly, that was none of Cary Grant's fucking business, no matter how much I admired him. Anyway, though we chatted for about an hour or so, I have basically no memory of what we discussed. Oh yeah, there was one thing. Chevy Chase and how he had insinuated on some talk show that Mr. Grant was bisexual. Now, as it happened, I was working on a film with Chevy at that time, a marvelous film called Under the Rainbow, a riveting film about the making of The Wizard of Oz, starring Chevy, me, Eve Arden, and 3,000 dwarves. And Chevy and I were getting along somewhat less than a house on fire. So on top of our LSD chat, we had that in common, poor Chevy Chase relations. So when our hour-long chat was up, I bid Mr. Grant a grateful goodbye, gleefully told all my friends, and end of story. Now, I thought, I had a Cary Grant story to tell my children and grandchildren for years to come, right? Well, as it turned out, actually no, not right. Because my Cary Grant story continued, and this time from an unexpected direction. A few years later, my father went to Princess Grace's funeral in Monaco. Please ask me if he actually knew the princess. Of course he didn't. My father had never even met the woman, either prior to her ascent to the throne when she was just plain old Grace Kelly, the Oscar-winning movie star, or after she became Monaco's very own Royal Highness. But I learned that you don't actually have to know the person whose funeral you're attending. In fact, sometimes, depending on the person, it's better that way. But my father had his own reasons for going to the funeral of this very famous, beautiful woman. Publicity. So there's my father wandering around aimlessly at this far-flung funeral of a famous woman, one of the few beautiful women of his generation that he hadn't slept with, schmoozing with thousands of other mourners, trying to make eye contact with someone who he could grieve with and maybe generate a photo op in the process, when he spies Cary Grant. And something clicked in his brain, and that something turned out to be the dim recollection of a story he'd only just recently been told. What was it again? Oh, yeah, something to do with his firstborn daughter. By now, he's walked up to my hero, and he says the first thing that pops into his head, which is something along the lines of, "My daughter Carrie is addicted to acid, and I'm very worried about her. Would you mind maybe having a talk with her?" Great. I've now gone from having an acid problem straight to a full-on LSD addiction, as if such a thing were possible. I'm mainlining the stuff. So here we go again. Poor Cary Grant, and I'm sure he's very rarely been called that, gets back from the funeral, and in due course calls me again to discuss my issue with slamming acid. Well, if I was embarrassed the first time he called me, this time I was completely humiliated. I explained to Mr. Grant, after thanking him profusely for taking the time out to counsel me on my alleged dependence on hallucinogens, that in fact, I didn't spend all that much time with my father, the time required to be able to accurately ascertain as to whether or not I had any sort of a problem, much less a drug one. I suggest to Mr. Grant that my mother would probably be in a much better position to determine whether or not I was tripping my brains out on a daily basis than my father, who I spent, on an average, one day a year with. So Mr. Grant says, well, it was very nice of your father to express his concern. It's very difficult to maintain a relationship with a child after the mother and father have divorced. I have a daughter myself, and I see her as much as I can. But when a child divides her time between two houses, no matter how you try, it's impossible to spend as much time with your child as you'd like to. So perhaps my father's motive hadn't been solely to find a subject matter to talk to Cary Grant about at the photo op funeral. Mr. Grant didn't seem to think so. So maybe this was another example of nothing ever being just one thing. No motive is pure, no one good or bad, but a hearty mix of both. And sometimes life actually gives to you by taking away. Anyway, Mr. Grant and I stay on the phone for over an hour talking about this and that, how he wishes he could be a more involved parent, you know, the usual shooting the shit with Cary Grant type thing. It was great. The phone call eventually comes to a close, and I immediately go to the liquor store and buy him a bottle of wine from his birth year, which is something like 1907. And now he calls me again to thank me. And in that final phone call, I believe he told me, I don't even like wine. I mean, we're ultimately talking about no less than 3 phone calls from Cary Grant. The guy was practically stalking me. Anyway, cut to a few months later, and I'm at this premiere or charity event or something. And I turn, and there, just a few feet away from me, actually in the flesh, as far in as you could get, is Cary Grant. Big as life and twice as famous. But this time, it's not just some disembodied voice that sounds a lot like Cary Grant. No, this is the real deal. Classy and handsome, and just about everything a human can possibly be when they're a DNA jackpot. But am I intimidated? Oh my God, yes. So, with my heart pounding in my ears and my nose and my hair, I sheepishly approach my ideal and very timidly tap him on the back, withdrawing my hand immediately as if I burned my finger on his radioactive, sizzling hot, iconic back. Whereupon Cary Grant turns, and I immediately start backing away from him, as though one of us was contaminated. Hi, I'm Debbie Reynolds' daughter, I admit, as though this was a crime. We talked on the phone. I'm stooped over like someone frightened and ashamed. Anyway, no big deal. I don't want to bother you. I just wanted to say hi. Oh, hello. Yes. How are you? I'm still backing up, forcing him to follow me. Oh, I'm fine, I whisper. Everything is great. It's so good to see you. Bye. And I fled the scene of this social crime, never to return. Years later, while I was in Australia doing some terrible film, they announced on the radio that Cary Grant had passed away. And I remember getting this pain, the kind you get when you experience a body blow or lose something essential. Who would talk me out of slamming LSD now? So I think to myself, after all this, you know, after all the nightclubs and the gay husband and the rehabs, one of my fellow inmates in the last rehab I was in was Ozzy Osbourne. That went well. So after all the rehabs and all the mental hospitals, I think to myself, if what doesn't kill you makes you, well, what doesn't kill you makes you not dead. But if what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I should be able to lift Cedars-Sinai Hospital and glow in the dark. So I say to myself at this point, bring it on! Don't ever say that, because it will be brought. Because that's when my friend Greg died. The newly made bystander. I didn't realize I actually had post-traumatic stress disorder at the time, but why would I think I had that? Anyway, how would I know which was post-traumatic stress, which is addiction, which is bipolar, which is Libra? Also, I thought you had to go to Iraq to get post-traumatic stress disorder. And you do. But you can also just come on over to my house. Anyway, a few months later, I guess my friends were getting worried about me because, you know, I wasn't talking, and most people know I'm essentially voice activated, and I was smoking like it was food. So finally, I agreed to go to this grief counselor they found for me. And my favorite thing that this woman said to me was, "I'm so sorry we had to meet under these conditions." Hello, you're a grief counselor. What other conditions would we meet under? Then she says, "I can't even imagine what you've been through." You can't? Well, if you can't, then I'm really fucked. Anyway, a couple weeks after this, my daughter Billy, who's about 13 at the time, tells me that when she grows up, she wants to be a neurologist with a specialty in schizophrenia. So I say, why not be a grief counselor? We'll see each other more. My daughter Billy is incredible. Even though she's a teenage girl and they so often end up thinking their mothers are lame and or insane. And in Billy's case, she's obviously not completely wrong. She's so pretty, though. She looks a lot like my mother. And she's a straight-A student, except for chemistry, and when's that going to come up? And she's a great writer, and she has this wonderful singing voice. Where'd she get that? Oh, and she just got her driver's license, so pray for me. Anyway, once, when Billy was about 4, we were driving along in Florida. And she sees this church, and she points to it, and she says, "Mommy, what's that?" And I said, "Well, baby, that's where people go to worship God." And she said, "God, like the God bless you God?" Like that's his main claim to fame. I took a job at one point when Billy was about 3 or 4 with a magazine who would send me to different places with her and one of her friends, and then I would write about it. I wanted to call it Billy's Holiday, but they ended up cleverly calling it Travels with Billy. So we got to go to all sorts of places. One time we went to Vegas and visited my mother's hotel, where there were actually slot machines that in order to win, you had to get 3 faces in a line of my mother's smiling face. But no matter how many times I tried to get a jackpot with my mother's head, I never seemed able to win. I couldn't hit the jackpot with my mother's smiling face. Now, if I dreamt that, a shrink would have a field day analyzing its deeper meaning. Billy has always been a very verbal and watchful child. And, you know, what's terrible nowadays is that you can get everything on TV and the internet. You know, you get movies that are rated PG or PG-13, but it's not a system that accurately indicates just how sophisticated or explicit these films are. Anyway, one day Billy and I were watching Muriel's Wedding, and I was thinking, well, this is okay, right? I mean, why shouldn't she see this? I didn't remember it as anything inappropriate. So I'm sitting there with her, and suddenly one of the girls in the movie says, "She sucked your husband's cock." And then another woman responds, "Oh, well, she also sucked your husband's cock." So I'm sitting there next to Billy, and I'm devastated. What do I say, if anything? She's about 7 at the time. So I say, "You don't think people actually do that, do you? Great, there's a brilliant point." And she looks sheepish and says, "No." Then, about 6 months later, we're watching yet another one of these movies that I think is totally fine when it happens again. Another actress makes a reference to going down on a man. So I say to Billy one more time, "You don't think people actually do that, do you?" I don't know what she's been exposed to between the internet and school, no matter how diligently I try to monitor it. This time she responds very quietly, "Yes." I'm totally unprepared for this, so I say, "Well, you don't think men actually like it, do you?" And to this she emphatically shakes her head no. So you can see how great I am insofar as it relates to training my daughter. I did tell her about the birds and the bees, but you kind of have to move really fast because of what kids are exposed to now. The weird thing is that when kids see porn before they have sex and... Well, actually, I'm a fine one to talk because when I was 15, I was in the chorus of my mother's show, like most teenagers, and the gay guys in the show showed me a movie called 16 Inches in Omaha to either shock me or watch my reaction. As you can imagine, this is a wonderful introduction to the male anatomy, so subtle and nuanced. Anyway, more recently, Billy told me, now she's changed her mind. She no longer wants to be a neurologist with a specialty in schizophrenia. Now she wants to be a comic, which, if you think about it, is a kind of natural progression. So I say, well, baby, if you want to be a comic, you got to be a writer. But don't worry, you've got tons of material. Your mother's a manic depressive drug addict, your father's gay, your grandmother tap dances, and your grandfather shot speed. And my daughter laughs and laughs and laughs. And I say, baby, the fact that you know that's funny is gonna save your whole life. Location, location, location. Now, if you had a daughter that great, you don't, but if you did, wouldn't you want to do something really nice for her? Right? Well, I did. I wanted her to have some, like, normal mommy memories of me, you know? Like, not just memories of a mother who got tattoos or hid Easter eggs in July. So what I did was I learned to cook. And it turns out I'm a pretty good cook. I mean, I make most of my meals at about 11 o'clock at night, but they're very, very delicious. Anyway, when I first learned to cook, my mother flipped out. It was like I was violating a family code or ethic or credo. I didn't even know we had those things. She would say, "Carrie's in the kitchen, cooking." You know, like she was saying, shaving her head. And what a weird thing to do in the kitchen, by the way. So one night I'm at her house. I told you we live next door to each other. And I say, "Oh, I'm going to go back up to my house and make Billy dinner." She grabs my arm and she says, "No! Why are you doing this? Please let me send Mary to make her chicken crepes." But I'm pleased to report that over time, my mother has become more accustomed to my cooking, so that now she says, "You know, dear, we had an Uncle Wally in the family that was a good cook." So if she can recognize it as a talent, especially one from her side of the family, she's cool with it. I heard someone once say that many of us only seem able to find heaven by backing away from hell. And while the place that I've arrived at in my life may not be precisely everyone's idea of heavenly, I could swear sometimes if I'm quiet enough, I can hear the angels sing. Either that or I've screwed up my medication. But one of the reasons I think my life is going so much better is that having originally done Wishful Drinking, the show, and now the book, as a singles ad, you know, like a really, really detailed personals ad, I think if I attract someone from one of my audiences or one of the readers of this book, he'll never be able to say, "You never told me you were a manic depressive drug addict that turned men bald and gay," like men say to me now. Because I'm no different than any other single person. I also want someone to love and treasure and overwhelm. Ooh, and disappoint, especially disappoint. I find that so erotic. Anyway, the ad worked. because when I did my show in Santa Fe, I received in the mail a marriage proposal. How great is that? Now, I told you I was manic depressive, right? So you know I have lousy judgment. So I was hoping that before I take such an enormous step, I could run the proposal past you and get you to somehow weigh in on it, okay? Keep in mind, I'm not getting any younger. Dearest Carrie Fisher, I want a relationship with you because I want to get married and have sex every night. Oh, because that's what you do when you're married. You are older than me, but I am a full-grown man of 41. I do love you, Carrie. Here are the most personal things about me. I have a big tummy, and I had an anus operation for hardened hemorrhoid bleeding. Well, which is good to know because now I can never say to him, "You never told me you had an anus operation for hardened hemorrhoid bleeding," like I would. I used to buy VHS videos for self-gratification since I was 15 to a couple years ago. I have had sex before, and I'm not a virgin since I was 14. I never had a girlfriend or been married because I was seeking stardom for myself until fall of 1982. Because you all remember what happened in fall of 1982. I love the band Duran Duran, and the movie Star Wars, and the TV shows MacGyver, and The Price is Right. Please feel free to write me. I love you, Carrie. So, what do you think? Should I marry him? Are you an optimist like Marie MacDonald? Come on, I want to get old with someone, not because of them, and I already have such a huge head start. A Spy in the House of Me. Before I wrap up, I'd like to share some of the wisdoms that I've learned from going through all this nonsense. First one, resentment is like drinking a poison and waiting for the other person to die. Saying you're an alcoholic and an addict is like saying you're from Los Angeles and California. Now, some of the wisdoms I've gotten from my grandmother, my mother's mother, the closet locker, who taught me a fly is as likely to land on shit as it is on pie, which is true if you think about it. She also said, cry all you want, you'll pee less. I don't know if this is true. But the main thing I learned all by myself, I needed no help. I learned not to get my tongue pierced. Because if you're getting your tongue pierced for the reason why I think you're getting it pierced, and you're not good at that thing to begin with, no little piece of jewelry's gonna save the day. I was talking to a priest friend of mine recently, as one does, and I was telling him how I was scheduled to meet with my daughter and her shrink the following week. It's going to be so difficult, I moaned. He shrugged. You've done difficult before. Well, who hasn't done difficult before? As I mentioned earlier, I turned 52 this year. And by the way, did you hear that they just made an announcement that 52 is the new 32? Or the new black. And I like to think of myself as a threshold guardian. There, but for the sake of me, go you. Now, if I've forgotten to tell you anything in these pages, it could be the ECT, could be bad memory, getting old, or it could be because there's just too much stuff stuck in my head. Now, Sherlock Holmes believed that the brain can only hold just so much information, so if he ever learned anything that was useless to his profession, he set about systematically to try to forget it. I like to quote fictional characters because I'm something of a fictional character myself, but my point is that I have something stuck in my brain, And because it's in there, I frequently get lost on my way to people's houses. I always forget people's names. And I leave my stuff everywhere, so my husband dictator has to pick up after me. And, at times, I forget parts of my show, which is how this whole thing got started. So now, I've written it down at least. Anyway, the following is the something that I have stuck in my brain, which I go about trying to systematically forget publicly here in these pages. And if you understood that, you're in desperate need of medication. It's a poem. Yes, as you probably guessed, a poem by George Lucas. General Kenobi, years ago you served my father in the Clone Wars. Now he begs you to help him in his struggle against the Empire. I regret that I am unable to present my father's request to you in person, but my ship has fallen under attack, and my mission to bring you to Alderaan has failed. I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. Proper copper coffee pot. My father will know how to retrieve it. You must see this droid safely delivered to him on Alderaan. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. I can't forget that stupid fucking hologram speech. That's why I did dope. Author's note. One of the things that baffles me, and there are quite a few, is how there can be so much lingering stigma with regards to mental illness. In my opinion, living with manic depression or depression takes a tremendous amount of balls. Not unlike a tour of duty in Afghanistan, though the bombs and bullets in this case come from the inside. At times, being mentally ill can be an all-consuming challenge, requiring a lot of stamina and even more courage. So if you're living with this illness and functioning at all, it's something to be proud of, not ashamed of. They should issue medals along with the steady stream of medications one has to ingest.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.